episode of Radio More Nerd. This is episode 46 now, and we're coming up close to our one-year anniversary, actually, which is interesting and scary and amazing. I had no idea we'd make it this far. Anyway, I'm co-host Mark Ames. I'm in Queens, New York, and I'm on the line with the War Nerd, a.k.a. John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Turin. How you doing, John? How's the B12 working?
I'm hoping it'll kick in. I mean, I still feel like vampires have been sort of having a go at me occasionally, but it'll get better over time. Catherine gives me my jab every day, and you know, you start looking forward to that jab.
Does it affect immediately? Do you feel it kind of immediately, like an antidote kind of thing?
If it's bad enough. Yes. I mean, it hasn't reached the point it did in Kurdistan, because in Kurdistan, I lasted a lot longer at stage 3 megaloblastic anemia than Brittany Murphy did. She died within 4 weeks, and I was several months in. I was vomiting every 10 to 15 minutes back then, and once I had that first B12 injection, I just stopped vomiting. Just boom, like that. It hasn't quite reached that point, so the change isn't as sudden. But I can walk further now. I can exercise better. It's a slow feeling that in my veins, red life might stream again, as Keats put it in his last poem. Didn't work out for him too well. Not a good omen, but it's a nice idea anyway.
So, just before the show, we were talking about these bombs. It didn't make that much news out here, but these bombs that blew up in several places, it seems like, in Thailand. And, I mean, the first thought, well, anyway, right now they've just had a vote on this sort of military junta's new constitution. I assume it's linked to that, or is
that's
it something
else? Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because the junta itself, which supposedly won this election with about 60% of the people saying yes, let's keep the military involved in running the country, and it's a very murky political system in Thailand. They very much want to say it must be the defeated factions, Ying Luck's red shirt faction. Basically the people who lost out in the Thai economic boom, who are doing this. And they're very strongly saying that, and they're absolutely denying any connection to terrorism. But these are provinces where the red shirts don't have any support. They're all in the south, where the separatist movement is very strong. They seem to be designed to insult the royal family. And I use the word insult advisedly. They were not mass killing bombs on the Islamic State model. They were sort of gesture bombs, little bombs and planters. But they went off in places like Hua Hin, which is where the Thai royal family has its summer residence, and across tourist towns like Phuket, and tourist islands like Phuket. And it just seems very unlikely that the losers of this election, within a week or so, organize all these bombs, 13 in all, and
or
set them off.
Or that they would try to insult or humiliate the royal family, right? That's something that you just, it's verboten.
Especially because they're ethnically Thai, and that they would not do that. That's one of the points that you just don't differ with among Thais. But if it was the Malay separatists, who are very ethnically distinct and operate mainly in the southern provinces, it makes a whole lot more sense. But the interesting thing about these bombs, well, there are two things. One is they don't seem to have been designed to kill a lot of people. And the other is we were there. I didn't want to make much of it at the time, but we were in Phuket in the neighborhood of Patong, where two bombs went off just a couple of months ago, and I didn't want to mention it because Phuket has such a party town rep that I thought our listeners would think I was wasting their hard-earned subscriptions.
You're like Leonardo DiCaprio of Warner.
Yeah, but the truth is, for reasons we didn't understand until we got there, it was a lot cheaper to stay in Phuket than in Bangkok. So we jumped at the chance. We used the site Agoda, which is good for hotels, especially in Asia, and we found these incredible deals where you could stay in Patong basically for free. And that's because I'm stupid, and I didn't bother to check that it was the monsoon season. So Patong is supposed to have a beach. You go down to the beach, and the waves are like 3 meters high, and if you put yourself under one of those waves, you're just going to become a meat patty. And Patong is also a strange place, and I can understand the bombs as a separatist move much better after staying there. We didn't stay there that long, got out as soon as we could, because I never met so many shills in my life. You can't walk anywhere near the beach or the main streets without running into shills. It's like shills of all nations.
Shills, what do you mean?
Like people trying to sell you on some scam.
Oh,
like,
okay.
Here's a ticket at random. Whoa, you won something. And to the Thai's credit, I have to say, very few of these people were Thai. They're not very good at that sort of thing. But they were from everywhere else. We met some amazing people. This Aussie who was doing a Crocodile Dundee act, not knowing that we were, well, one of us at least is from Australasia, and that it was painful to listen to. We met this 2 meter tall Eastern European. We met this white South African couple on a Harley. We met a team of South Asian guys who were trying to sell us on the idea that we'd won some fake trip. It's not something you encounter much in Thailand, but it's all over Phuket, and it's kind of a sleazy place, and I'm not particularly allergic to sleaze, so for the sleaze to really hit us, it had to be pretty intense. But the thing is, that's the main drag. A lot of police booths, too, a lot of statues representing Thai royal iconography, and that is almost inevitably Buddhist iconography. But once you get off those main streets in Patong, most of the population is wearing the hijab, and there are little mosques on all the side streets, little signs saying masjid this way.
Mm.
And when you look at an ethnic map of Thailand, Phuket is basically the northern border
of
the big divide between ethnically Thai and ethnically Malay. So it makes sense that would be a place you'd target. I mean, there's a lot of sleaze in Phuket. It occasionally offended us, and we're not Wahhabi exactly, but it made a kind of sense. And so basically, what's happening is the Thai junta is trying to say, oh, this must be the guys who lost the election, and we absolutely rule out the possibility that it was Malay insurgents from the south. And that sounds like a lie. That's just not
right.
A good
story. Because they don't want to give the appearance of instability in any way. Their whole thing is, you know, the civilians can't really run things. We're the only ones that can bring peace and order here. And if they admit that this was actually separatist bombings, suddenly what's the purpose of having these guys running things?
Exactly. Yeah. The whole rationale for their taking power is gone. And these were kind of gesture bombs. These were a way of saying we can not only strike in the three far south provinces where we are the majority, we can go much further north. I mean, Hua Hin is about level with Pattaya. You know, it's definitely not a Malay town, and it is a residence of the royal family. And the Thai royal family, I mean, you and I went there together. It's a deadly serious matter. At the beginning of every film, you have to stand up and while the anthem is played and photos of the king are shown. You don't insult the royal family unless you're saying we're serious. And yet the goal doesn't seem to have been kill a whole bunch of people. There were a total of 4 deaths in 13 bombs over a couple of days. They were small bombs planted in potted plants. And although I've heard about ball bearings in some of the bombs, it doesn't make sense that 13 bombs that were actually full of ball bearings would only kill 4 people, because you set these off at tourist spots where people are gulping down beer outdoors at night, and you're going to slaughter a lot of people. This was something else. This was very odd, very interesting, a way of saying, we are here, we can strike outside the area that you think we can, and we can do something like one of these al-Qaeda simultaneous bombing things on a very big scale, but without trying to kill masses of civilians.
And also it says, you know, you guys haven't solved every problem. So
right.
Now you think, you know, you've solved your whatever problem with democracy and you're coming back. Well, now you're going to remember us as well.
Yeah.
But it's definitely not an Islamic State style of bombing. It's
more, no, definitely not. I actually looked up videos from Patong of some of the places that got bombed because I had a vague memory of them. And there are places where a bunch of people are sitting at outdoor cafes, drinking mainly, and it would be the easiest thing in the world to leave a backpack full of ball bearings on one of those tables and walk away, and you'd kill a lot of people. Or if you just wanted to kill a lot of Thais who matter, a lot of middle-class Thais, you just bomb the Bangkok metro system. This is something else. This is, it's a very symbol-oriented part of the world, and the whole royal family. It was the Queen's birthday, which makes it a big royal day. Mm. It was bomb as insult rather than weapon in the Gettysburg or Stalingrad sense, bomb as slap in the face.
Another sort of attempted, apparently, bombing campaign happened in Crimea. What we know is this, as far as I understand it, that over the weekend, a group of Ukrainians infiltrated across the Crimean border. And as you've written about before, I mean, that already, I think, is a major problem if you're a commander there. It's a tiny border. That's why that's what the Russian, the real strategy was to take Crimea, and the Donbass is going to be something to negotiate. But
right.
It's defensible. It's 8 kilometers long, and it's full of, you know, Russian military and intelligence people. And yet, apparently, maybe up to 20 Ukrainians apparently slipped through, or you know, people backed by the Ukrainian military or intelligence. They attacked a border post. They killed one border guard. They got through, and then they sort of hid out, I don't know, in the forest, and then they got found by the Russians, and then there was a firefight, and one FSB officer was killed. So that's a pretty high-value target. And
yeah.
Apparently, and this all happened for a couple of days, and the Russians didn't say anything about it and started coming out on social media and still said nothing about it. So apparently, most of the Ukrainians, particularly apparently the commanders of this operation, got away and got back across the border. And a few of their people that they hired to help them locally to do spotting and to drive them around, and they'll just look like regular schlubs, they got picked up. They found a lot of small bomb-making devices on them, and they showed these bomb-making devices. And what the Russians are saying when they finally talked about it after it broke out all over this, you know, social media and everything, they said that these guys were planning to set off a bunch of small bombs, like at the airport, bus station, railway station, some other areas. And apparently, one version I hear is that then they would blame it on Crimean, they would say it was done by Crimean Tatar radicals.
Wow.
In order, I think, to bring a harsh crackdown more, a harder crackdown on the Crimean Tatars and to radicalize them more. That's what the Russians are saying, at least some versions of it. Other versions, they haven't talked about the Crimean Tatar angle or pinning it on the Crimean Tatars.
But the delay itself suggests that they were either embarrassed
yes.
or uncertain about how to play it.
Yes, that's what I think, too. I mean, if it was... So what the Ukrainians and the U.S. ambassador saying that the Russians invented the whole thing and you can't trust them and they're liars and Kremlin hybrid warfare. And this is also tourist season. Also.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. And Russians value that beach visit more than just about anything.
Oh, yeah. It's sort of the second season of it. So they're trying to turn it into the Russian place. I mean, it already was a... you know, Russian place to go, but not the main one, but they're trying to turn it more and more into, you know, instead of Turkey, go to Crimea and Russianize it even more. Yeah.
And as you say, in a professional sense, it's kind of embarrassing because Crimea is one of the most inherently defensible places, at least from the land, that you can imagine. I mean, it's a diamond-shaped peninsula and you just defend the northern tip of the diamond.
Yeah, no, exactly. And then around the same time, Erdogan had his big summit meeting with Putin in Petersburg. And this one is, we've all been, and it's still very confusing what's going on there. There's just no doubt it's confusing. But now we're seeing like week after week, it seems pretty real at this point that Erdogan really does want to repair relations with the Russians and is starting probably to see a lot of advantages to it. But among other things that were so surprising is, you know, out of the meeting, they talked about how they're now going to carry out joint strikes on Islamic State. I mean, bombing Islamic State seems to be just this sort of, it's the greaser that brings everybody together, you know. It's
like, sandworms, don't you hate them? I hate them too.
Yeah, and so they're going to do that, which is just incredible considering where the two countries were 6 months ago, 3 months ago. The foreign minister, I think, was talking about Turkey looking for a different military alliance outside of NATO, which is really amazing.
Yeah.
The main thing is they were clearly hurting. They were paying way too heavy of a price, Turkey was, from the sanctions. And that was a problem. And not just from tourism, but from all the business deals that they have going on in Russia. And so all of those are being repaired fast. But like a couple things I was thinking about in their meeting is I assume that they brought up the Crimean Tatars because Turkey has historically kind of, you know, been the protectors or the representatives of Crimean Tatars, and a lot of them live there in Turkey as well. I assumed that was brought up, and I also assumed that Erdogan, who's now arrested like I guess 50,000 people and, you know, it keeps growing and he's still purging, and he's just thinking, why should I listen to the U.S. and the West anymore after all of this? They, at best, stood on the fence and played both sides of this thing.
Yep.
Why
yep.
should I? Vlad is not going to give me any shit over these arrests and this purge, and he never will. And I think, and I brought this up to you earlier, I think he saw that Russia, for the first time, went beyond its borders and took care of a client state and are still backing up this client, you know, Assad and the Alawites in Syria. And as you said, this is the first time they've really done this in quite a while. And this might be part of the payoff for that a guy like Erdogan looks and sees, you know, Russia does stand by its allies and its commitments. However bad these people are, they're the clients.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe these guys are reliable.
Yeah, whereas the U.S. is a real pain in the ass from Erdogan's perspective. I mean, it's involved with the Kurds, whom he truly hates, he and his Turkish nationalists. And it's never been very much in favor of his more radical social moves. And it tends to be a busybody about a lot of things that he finds inconvenient. And the EU is still dragging its heels. These people are just a nuisance. And here you've got this choice of a new ally that would be a lot easier to deal with man to man, using that term advisedly, you know, Erdogan to Putin. I'm a strong man, you're a strong man, let's run these places sensibly. The thing about the Turkish coup that keeps bothering me is that it didn't make any sense.
I'm still don't get. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, and then I'll tell you.
Well, I was just going to say, who were they planning to bring out on the streets? I mean, you have a disaffected officer corps, but so what? I mean, as the whites proved in the Russian Civil War, you need troops, not just officers, and you need civilians to back those troops. And the idea that the left or the Kurds or the Alevi or any of those people who've been persecuted by the Turkish military would come out in support of the Turkish officer corps makes no sense. But suppose there's a faction of the Turkish officer corps that trained in Texas, is really strongly attached to the NATO-US alliance, and maybe doesn't like this new turn towards Russia, and was shocked out of its mind when Erdogan comes as close as somebody like him could ever come to apologizing for shooting down that Russian fighter. That might have made a lot of Turkish officers angry. That makes sense from their view.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I've seen one of the theories is that was sort of the last straw, actually, when he apologized and started talking about and warmed up relations very fast. It was a slap in their face. In a huge way, and they've never had that kind of slap in the face, I think, since Kemal created Turkey. I doubt the military has ever dealt with something like that. No. And so I think the question, though, also is what was America's role in this? Erdogan clearly is acting like and may very well believe that the U.S. is behind it, you can see why. I mean, we do take care of Gulen. A lot of these officers, I'm sure the ones who hate him the most are the ones that are probably closest to the NATO crowd and the NATO way of thinking, right? My only thing that I keep coming back to is that it's not the CIA way of doing revolutions, certainly not for the last 20, 30 years. I mean, the CIA way is to always get a popular movement and to tap into genuine grievances. And so it's kind of like these, these coups that have a kind of quasi-popular mandate, or at least a plausibly popular mandate in some way or another, even if they don't have that. And this just completely ignored anything to do with the people. Now, maybe I've been having this back and forth with Thierry Marignac out in France about it. And, you know, there's a couple of possibilities. One is, well, I'm making the assumption that the U.S. and CIA are always incredibly competent, you know, which is a bad idea. I mean, it could just be that the officers convinced their American counterparts, whether they were in on it or not, or they just convinced themselves, no, the people love us. They just want to see us take it over. And then, you know, and then there'll be a cakewalk and they'll greet us as liberators. I mean, that's been a mistake time and time again of all kinds of people throughout the years, right? Maybe that partly explains it.
Yeah, I mean, or they may have just said, okay, go for it. Let's see if you can do it. I mean, it's sort of like letting an expendable proxy take a chance. Terrible things will happen to the proxy, and I'm sure some unimaginably terrible things are happening to the people who are involved in the coup right now. But their American liaison officers aren't really going to suffer. And there were already some tensions between them and Erdogan's people. Those Gulenists are pretty expendable. Gulen can still be used. He's still sitting there in the Poconos in Pennsylvania. I mean, you're on the East Coast. I don't really know what Poconos means. I thought it always meant like, I don't know, is that where people go in the summer? Some kind of summer?
I think it's, one of those resortish kind of areas in it, like low hills, because they don't have things like the Sierra Nevada. They don't have mountains like we do in the West. Right. So for them, a low hill is like, you know, something dramatic and beautiful.
Yeah, well, he's still there, and the U.S. maybe didn't risk very much and wanted to give Erdogan something to think about, that, you know, they can still pull some strings there. But, you know, there are other strings to be pulled, and that's the Erdogan AKP position, which is, well, we'll talk to our Russian friends. And there are a lot of things that are looking that way. There was a very, very interesting dispatch in the fight for Aleppo from a Syrian Arab Army general, that is an Assad general, who said, the Russian aircraft aren't helping us anymore as we try to contain the breakout of this siege that we finally managed to encircle Aleppo with. Why aren't the Russians helping us? They should be helping us. And when you consider all these other moves that are going on between Russia and Turkey, there is starting to get that look of a big, quiet deal being made.
Yeah. What sort of deal do you think? Because I'm also thinking maybe this also partly explains the, you know, the open Al-Qaeda alliance from our side too. Like, you know, Turkey will sort of side with Russia, and it's starting to warm up to Iran, and maybe it's going to be harder to get people and weapons through, so let's rush it all through now and do our big breakout now. I don't know. What do you see?
Well, I think the one thing you can see from the Western press and its quasi-official spokespeople is that the Russian airstrikes were doing too well. Hezbollah, the Iranian advisors, and the various Shia militia recruited from around the world were doing too well. And to the people who matter in the West in general, and especially in the U.S., that is the one intolerable outcome. I mean, it doesn't matter if Islamic State crucifies half the population of Syria. For some reason that does, and I don't claim to understand why, but for some reason that doesn't bother them. But if the Alawite, Hezbollah, Iranian alliance begins to win the war, that's intolerable. So suddenly Jabhat al-Nusra changes its name to Jabhat Fatah al-Shams, the support front for the conquest of Syria. It rejects any alliance with al-Qaeda because, like you say, 9/11 still gives Americans a bad allergic reaction, and al-Qaeda carried out 9/11. So suddenly there's this Sunni Arab militia in Syria, which is Wahhabi. If it weren't for Islamic State, they would seem like the most extreme Wahhabists you could imagine. They will fight. They will send lots and lots of people in armor-plated, welded pickups straight into enemy blockades. And suddenly those people are useful again, because the one outcome nobody who matters really wants is for the Shia alliance to gain something like a real advantage in the war. And that's a point at which a CIA liaison officer, an FSB liaison officer, and Erdogan's MIT, Turkish military intelligence, might all agree. So suddenly all these TOW missiles from Qatar and everywhere else start flooding into the besieged parts of Aleppo and flooding into the militia, which until a couple of weeks ago was openly pro-Al-Qaeda. And suddenly nobody in the Western press seems to mind that we and our friends are now rearming these guys who, until they made this promise with both fingers crossed, that they were Al-Qaeda and that they totally supported Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I got to read you, I mean, of the article. So the role of Al-Qaeda, or recently rebranded, not Al-Qaeda, in the Aleppo offensive that was successful. It's reported, but very, very hushed or buried, you know, 20 paragraphs down in the Western, at least in the American press. But here's a story. This one of the few that was a little more open about it, I guess, is from the Financial Times, from August 8th, outside help behind rebel advance in Aleppo. And I'm just going to read you a couple of these paragraphs. It's just, again, what amazes me is the apathy about the Al-Qaeda alliance that we forged. But anyway, they and others believe the money and supplies for Jabhat al-Nusra and Al-Qaeda came from regional backers, including Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and were sent in trucks across Turkey's border with Syria. This was in spite of the fact that the rebel offensive, dubbed the Great Aleppo Battle, has been led and organized by Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, a jihadi group formerly known as Jabhat al-Nusra. Some rebels claim that U.S. officials supporting moderate rebel forces, there's moderates again, intentionally turned a blind eye to Fatah al-Sham, i.e. al-Qaeda's, participation in the offensive to ensure the opposition maintains a foothold in Aleppo. And here's a quote from a Western diplomat. The Americans, of course, knew what was going on. They ignored it to put some pressure on Russia and Iran. So we're basically saying we're allying with Al-Qaeda to teach Russia and Iran a lesson. I mean, how fucking twisted is that? That is just beyond twisted.
Yeah, it's as we were saying last week, you know, you try to be cynical when you do this job because it's part of the job, but you can't be cynical enough. And the one part I would disagree about is Russia. What if Iran is probably still aligned with the Alawites, Hezbollah, and to some extent the Kurds, but what if Russia is considering a real pivot toward Turkey? Then they might not mind this at all. They might not mind having some of their clients displaced by a much more valuable new client state, and Turkey would be an incredible gain Russia. I mean, you give up a lot to gain a Turkish alliance, and that means that, you know, Kurdish history, and I lived there, and I really got to love those people. And Kurdish history is a nightmare, and it has that horrible feel of the next episode of The Nightmare is about to begin.
Yeah, that's I get where you're going at. And think of it from the Russian point of view. Not only, I mean, there's so many advantages to this. And there are for Erdogan as well. It's just, but for Russia, you know, a lot of their problems in the Caucasus, in their former empire, you know, republics in Central Asia. I mean, if they had a good, a positive accommodation with the Turks, I mean, that pulls a giant thorn that they've had to deal with, especially since, you know, the Soviet Union fell apart. It would. And then suddenly they'd be freed up to extend their power even more. I can't imagine that. That's something I cannot imagine that the U.S., the West, the CIA would allow to go unanswered, you know.
Well, except, you know, that there's something, and again, I can't fully explain it, but there's something that is consistent, just about the one consistent, if not logical, thing in U.S. policy in Syria. The Alawite, Hezbollah, Iran faction cannot win.
Yeah.
Whatever else happens is fine, but those guys cannot win.
Right.
So they'll put up with an awful lot as long as it hurts those guys.
Which is kind of incredible because, you know, last week also you talked about the insanity of the thinking that Sunni militia, Sunni fighters could never will always be bad fighters, or they'll never reach the level of a Hezbollah. That's kind of the calculation here. And yet everyone agrees that Jabhat al-Nusra are really good fighters, and that their operation that they carried out, you know, mix of suicide bombings and bold attacks, was really impressive. I mean, it looks like the Western military, the coalition, they're all kind of high-fiving each other over it. But if I were Israel, for example, who has been, you know, at times openly helping Jabhat al-Nusra, I would be, if I weren't stupid, I would be a little worried about that.
Yeah, and yet they're not. That's very clear. The one thing that's been clear from the beginning of the war is if Hezbollah gets any weapons that might be potentially dangerous, they get zapped within a couple of hours. But it doesn't really matter what the Sunni militias do. It doesn't matter if you can wave to them from the Golan Heights. It just doesn't seem to bother Israel very much. And to me, it's one of those moments where you're watching a moment of madness. You know, there are these things throughout history that you ask yourself, how could they have thought that? But somehow they do think that.
Yeah, I know. It's bizarre. It is really bizarre. So I think we can move from there to the main subject, which is the eighth anniversary of the Georgia-Ossetia War, which has had a lot of, it's not just an anniversary, but it also has reverberated in a lot of ways. I mean, this was the first war for Russia that really did change the perception of Russia and both with, I mean, their own perception of what they can do. And then I think some of the outside world that they can actually project their power now beyond their borders. And, you know, it's hard to remember, but in the 90s, I mean, I think as the Exile once wrote, like they couldn't have defeated the Jamaican bobsled team in a battle. I mean, they just got, you know, it was painful. It was painful, and I'm sure they're still reeling from it. And it's kind of amazing how quickly they turned around. But I remember David Filipov, one of the foreign correspondents, telling me after he got back from Chechnya in 2000, after, you know, so he was able to compare the 96 and the one in 2000, the two wars. And he said, you know, these Russians, they got their asses handed to them in 96, but they also had the, you know, training basically against the most fearsome fighters on earth. Yeah. And that made them a lot smarter and a lot better. And they're not the same that they were back then at all anymore.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure our reader, I mean, our listeners, remember that the first, Russian, invasion of Chechnya was just a bloody disaster with scared draftees in BMPs getting hit with RPGs from apartment house rooftops and no way to respond at all, just idiot commanders leading their traditional Soviet-style armored columns down streets they didn't know. It was like what happened in Mogadishu on a much bigger scale, and it was deeply humiliating. It was part of a pattern of humiliation in those years that you couldn't help but feel if you were in Russia. That feeling of national humiliation went very, very deep. And then they, like you say, they learned. They stopped sending in masses of badly trained troops in lightly armored vehicles, and they started fighting a smarter and dirtier and quieter counterinsurgency war with the traditional technique of highly trained mercenaries. I mean, often patriotic mercenaries, but then, you know, right. So are a lot of our guys in Iraq were patriotic mercenaries, but they still liked the money. These kontraktniki liked the money, and they were also probably patriotic Russian veterans. They learned to fight an insurgency in the traditional way, which is you grab somebody and you start doing things to him until he gives you a name, and then you grab that person until he gives you a name, and pretty soon you have a lot of names, and you take it from there. Yeah. So, I mean, we've been talking about the way the world was surprised. This actually fits in rather neatly. We were talking about the way the world was surprised by the fact that Russia in Syria fought effectively, was not discouraged by initial gloating from the Western press about how it wasn't going to work, and backed its friends very coolly, very consistently. But that wasn't really as sudden as it looked to most people, because they had learned some really hard lessons in those two Chechen wars. And a lot of those lessons got applied in the war we're going to talk about now, one which Mark Ames actually personally saw some of, the Georgia War of 2008.
Right. So, I'll give just a quick background on myself and then sort of try and give a history, a lead up. How I wound up in the South Ossetian War. So in June of 2008, the Kremlin raided my newspaper, The Exile, shut it down. So I kind of fought it in the press, and then things got ugly, and some Putin cronies started threatening me, and so I had to leave the country fast. Got a one-way ticket, got out, left all my stuff behind. Waited about 2 months, and then thought, I got to go back and pick up everything that I left behind. And, you know, the worst that they're probably going to do if they don't want me there is they just won't let me in at the airport. If they let me in, it means everything's blown over and they have other problems and it's August. So nobody noticed. I flew in. I went to grab my stuff. And the next day, suddenly there was news that, well, the news that was coming in Russia was that Georgia had shelled and bombed South Ossetia. The news that was coming in on the American side was Russia, without any provocation, had invaded Georgia for no reason whatsoever except that Georgia was a Jeffersonian democracy and Russia, Putin could not handle and could not survive the success of a Jeffersonian Western democracy on his southern border, and so he wanted to punish them. That was how it was coming out. And I knew number two was complete BS because I knew all about Saakashvili. I knew about his neocon ties. I knew what an authoritarian he was, how much he was already becoming hated by a lot of Georgians, and kind of what a nutcase he is, too.
Yeah.
That was even evident in 2003 in the Rose Revolution. He was impressive, but, you know, back then his reputation was... The little that we knew about him in 2003, the tagline was basically, oh, he's Georgia's Zhirinovsky. Zhirinovsky being the kind of the flamboyant fascist in Russia. That's what they said about him. And then he took power and suddenly he's like, no, he's pro-Western and so on, but a nationalist.
And he's got, and I really think this matters, especially we were talking a while ago about South Sudan and Riek Machar, who has a PhD from a British university and married a British aid worker. And as a consequence, it's very popular in Britain, despite some questionable records. Saakashvili, in the same way, has deep, deep roots to the U.S. elite, right?
And he went to Columbia Law School.
And, yeah.
So I met one of his would-be cabinet members the year before when the Green Berets went in, and I did a story there. He went to Georgetown and had, like, little NATO flags in his office and so on. And, you know, again, one of the hard things about talking about this is I have a lot of sympathy for the Georgians. But they don't come off well in this at all. But I do. I've always liked the Georgians a lot, for which I took a lot of shit from friends of mine, and not so much the Russians, but definitely my one Ossetian friend. And that's how I kind of know the Ossetian story. But they're great. I don't know. I've liked everyone I've met. I love the place. You go there and you just think, well, you know, yeah, I don't blame them for being pissed off that they have this giant neighbor to the north that they can't get away from. Then the really question is, okay, well, do you deal with the reality or do you do something crazy to try to get out of a situation you actually can't get out of? That's been, I think, one of... And the Georgians are, there's just no doubt about it, historically very... politically chauvinistic and arrogant and chauvinistic and at times very violently so. I mean, they are, I just remember all the anecdote they would tell about Russians and, you know, when they would say when we converted to Christianity, they were the second nation that converted to Christianity after the Armenians back in like 317 or something. They said, when we were doing this, the Russians were still swinging from trees. That was like one of the ones I remember. But, you know, and then on the other hand, like a friend of mine, we'll just call him Deadhead Dave, I guess, you know, he told me he went to Georgia in 1988, I think, the first time. And he loved telling the story, and it's absolutely true, that about Georgian hospitality. He said, so he brought his cousin out. His cousin was a winemaker, and they maybe knew some winemaking deals. They went to a restaurant in Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. And Dave said, if you want to understand Georgians, I want to show you something. We're on one side of this restaurant. Try to walk across this room to the other side of the restaurant without, and actually be able to like touch the wall and see what happens. And, you know, by halfway through, he was dragged to some stranger's tables. They're hugging him. They're making him drink wine, toasts, khachapuri, you know.
Wow.
And so, that's incredible. How it is. And they're really fun and friendly.
Yeah, I mean, but I mean, look, part of this is the neighborhood. I mean, there's some neighborhoods you don't want to live in. I mean, you mentioned Armenia. We've talked about Armenia with Turkey to the west and Azerbaijan to the right. Georgia is just to the north of that, along a big old Russian Persian fault line, a big old Christian Islamic fault line. The Chechnya is to the northeast of Georgia. The Russians are to the northwest. You can't probably afford to be a Quaker nationality in that neighborhood and last very long. Maybe we need to go into the geography.
Exactly. Yeah, why don't because this is your line here. I love this one. Think of Georgia as a big mouth.
Yeah, try opening to take a bite out of the Black Sea. I mean, and even though we're talking about a relatively small area, as everywhere in the Caucasus, and maybe we can get an anthropologist or something someday to tell us why this should be particularly true of the Caucasus. Every few miles, there can be changes of ethnicity, which are matters of life and death if you wander into the wrong valley or speak the wrong language or call a bridge or a stream by the wrong name. So Georgia, is basically shaped like a mouth.
On the eastern end of the Black Sea, it should be.
It's traditionally where Jason went to get the Golden Fleece. And in fact, when Greece started evacuating its own citizens in Georgia during the war, they cleverly called it Operation Golden Fleece. There are three ethnic enclaves within Georgia, and an ethnic enclave in this part of the world is a really dangerous thing because the whole, you know, diversity thing has not caught on in a big way. So I said there are three teeth that are kind of loose, like gulag prisoners' teeth used to be from the scurvy. There's Adjaria, the bottom front tooth, Abkhazia, the top front tooth along the coast and the Russian border. And then there's South Ossetia, like right in the middle top of this mouth, like a top molar, but maybe a little, you know, forward of a molar. I just don't know what you call those teeth in the middle of the mouth. That's Georgia, that mouth shape. And Ossetia, which is usually half of it, South Ossetia, is inside what is now the Georgian border. The other half, North Ossetia, is outside that Georgian border, but the Ossetians consider themselves, as far as I know, one nation.
Yeah. I think there's minor differences in the dialects of Ossetian that they speak. And they're divided by a very high mountains around there, too. And the Roki Tunnel, I think the Roki Tunnel was only finished in 1985, if I'm not mistaken. It's a 2-mile-long tunnel. It's a pretty amazing tunnel, you know, going through it. I went through it actually in Russian armored vehicles, if I remember right. Yeah, and it takes a long time.
Did you really? Hey, how's the ride in Russian armored vehicles?
Bumpy.
Yeah, very bumpy. I bet they didn't waste a lot of money on shocks. And,
yeah, no,
always
no, no.
Absorption.
Yeah, it was pretty bumpy. It takes a long time to get through that tunnel, and as we'll talk about a little bit later, Dick Cheney tabled the possibility of bombing the Russians as they came out of the Roki Tunnel on the Jordan side.
Because this tunnel basically divides North Ossetia from South Ossetia.
Exactly.
That is the part
exactly.
Ossetia that's outside of Georgia from the part that is inside of Georgia, and which the Georgians were now trying to suppress because they considered the South Ossetians to be rebels, right?
Right, and we should also say that, you know, that they are distinct, because there was a lot of this, you know, it's really disgusting, this sort of denial. You know, it's like the Palestinians aren't a people, BS about the South Ossetians. There was a lot of this in the Western press. I seem to remember maybe it was John Lloyd in the Financial Times, somebody saying like that it was completely invented and there's not even really a South Ossetia or South Ossetian people. Well, they speak a completely different language. They speak a Persian language. They're Orthodox Christian. They are, if you look at the Russian North Caucasus, so that whole area that borders Georgia's northern border, and it's Russia's southern border, you know, there's like a domino of several Muslim republics, Chechnya, Dagestan, Ingushetia, and they're all Muslim, and then North Ossetia, and that's Orthodox Christian, and then you go back to like Kabardino, Balkaria, and Cherkessia or something. So it's surrounded on all sides by... It's a rough neighborhood, you know.
Yeah.
The
Chechen militants certainly considered the Ossetians alien enough and infidel enough and pro-Russian enough to commit one of the most horrible massacres in recent times there.
Yes. One other kind of cool thing about the Georgians is their language. Apparently, the only language that Georgian has any relationship to, according to some linguists, is Basque. In Spain.
Wow.
And the Romans, you know, used to call their name for Georgia when they were conquering the Black Sea was Iberia, which is the Iberian Peninsula. Yeah, and you know, they still have like a lot of Georgian restaurants would be named Iberia. I didn't quite put it all together for a while, but that's a theory anyway. That because Basque also, you know, they've never been able to find out what Basque is related to.
Wow.
So maybe that. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Whereas the Ossetians apparently descended from the ancient Alani, these sort of nomadic horse, cavalry riding fighters, supposedly may have become part of the Roman guard, kind of like frontline troops, and they were used to help conquer Britain, and supposedly King Arthur may have had some Alani blood in him. I don't know.
Did you see the movie about that by that French director, by the way?
No. So this has been around more than just the Ossetians.
Yeah, it's been around. It was a big flop. I mean, Clive Owen had to play King Arthur, and Keira Knightley was his Celtic love interest. Celtic at the moment meaning lots of curly hair and tattoos and hiding in the forest and thwacking people with bows and arrows. But yeah, he played an Alani cavalry officer in the last days of the Roman service as the real bad guys, that is the Saxons, start to invade. So yeah, that idea has been around for a while. Big enough to get its own script made.
Right.
Not just options, you understand. Made.
So the Georgians had their Great Kingdom era, their high point. Was around 1,000 years ago, 12th, 13th century, particularly under their sort of most famous king for them, which is called David the Builder. And he extended the empire, I think, throughout the Caucasus into Azerbaijan, north, south, parts of Turkey. But then after that, you know, that lasted a couple of years, they were subjugated again, and they were generally having to cut deals with or being subjugated by either the Persian-Iranian empires or the Ottoman Empire. And so finally in 1783, and this is, you know, this is kind of an interesting and horrible story. In 1783, the Georgian aristocrats finally went to Catherine the Great. She was conquering more territory, and they thought, you know, it would be best if we got protected by fellow Orthodox Christians. So they signed the Treaty of Georgievsk. It was King Irkle the second, this is the Georgian king, signed it with Catherine the Great, and it made Georgia a Russian protectorate. And I'm getting some of this from Tom DeWall's book, but as I understand it, shortly afterwards, the Russians, or at some point, they just pulled their whole military garrison out of Tiflis, which was what Tbilisi, the capital, was called then, left them completely vulnerable. King Erkla said, "Now you are leaving Georgia to the extreme despair of our subjects." And shortly after, Iran invaded 1795 Persia and totally razed and destroyed Tiflis. The place was completely leveled. And then forever thereafter, certainly in the 19th century, the Russians would say, "You see what happens when you're not with us? You have to be a protector of ours, or that's going to happen again." So it was a It looked
but
like
if, okay, but officially yeah. they were with the Russians, right? And they did expect the Russians to help.
I know, but, you know, I don't know the exact details. Maybe they gave a little bit of lip knowing the Georgians, you know, something in the Russian. The Russians wanted to teach them a lesson. You know, you see what happens, Donnie, when you fuck a protector in the ass. but it was brutal.
Yeah, I actually think that's part of the Russian reputation that the people in charge of Putin's administration are very strongly trying to live down now, because
yes.
there's a long record of betrayal of allies by the Soviet Union and Tsarist Russia before that, and I think they're really, as we were saying before, trying to show people, not this time, okay, you can count on us, we're not going to do that to you this time.
One thing is that the Georgian elite and the sort of the upper class or aristocrats, they were, again, people love Georgians. It's just true. So they were among the few kind of nationalities that were really allowed to be officially part of kind of the aristocratic court scene in Petersburg and Moscow. And what that meant was, towards the end of the 19th century, you had started having a lot of Georgians very well educated in Russia and picking up these advanced radical ideas that were coming out of Russia. And so, you know, one of the leaders of the leader of the Mensheviks that split off from the Bolsheviks in 1903 to create the Mensheviks was a Georgian Marxist, Noe Jordania. And the Georgian Mensheviks were very powerful. And as we know, even the Georgian Bolsheviks were too, because Stalin was one.
Right.
So in World War I, Georgia wound up being able to declare independence. You know, Russia basically completely fell apart. Georgia cut a deal with the Germans, for which, again, they were not punished at the Treaty of Versailles, as the books say, because they were so charming. Whereas the Armenians were given
they invited over everybody for some wine.
Exactly. It works, you know. We forget we're mammals. I mean... Yeah. You know, that does matter. So they were independent, very independent, as a Menshevik republic from 1917 to 1921. And this was a very bad period for Georgia's minorities. I'm just going to read a couple things here. I mean, even DeWall, again, who we've talked about before, he's good, he's smart, he's definitely he's like an Episcopalian liberal. British liberal, you know, we thought he was a little bit too friendly to Azerbaijan. He's definitely not a Russophile, put it that way. He's interested in that region, but he's definitely not a Russophile. I've read his Chechnya book, which I thought was also good, but slanted. And here's what he says. He says, the Mensheviks antagonized Georgia's smaller nationalities. They waged brutal campaigns to incorporate Abkhazia and South Ossetia, sowed tensions in Ajaria, where the Muslim population resisted school education being imposed upon them. So between 1918 and 1920, the South Ossetians, who were against being basically cut off from their brothers, the North Ossetians, and who were now just in the Soviet Russia, to the Soviet foreign minister, complained to the Georgian foreign minister about the treatment of South Ossetians. And the Georgian foreign ministry in 1920, the Menshevik foreign minister, responded, there is no South Ossetia within Georgia.
Wow.
And so the Georgian People's Guard, the Menshevik People's Guard, attacked shortly afterwards. And the commander that attacked described Ossetians as, quote, our worst and most relentless enemies, and said, these traitors should be cruelly punished. There is no other way. Now, this is a small population, right? I mean, this is probably at that time around 50, 60,000 people. They killed almost 5,000 people. It's almost 10%. That's why Ossetians call it a genocide. They call all these a genocide because it's a very, I mean, even the war in 2008, about 1% of the population of the capital city, Tsinvali, was killed by the Georgian shelling. And so even if you're talking about 700 people killed, well, that's the equivalent in New York of, 70,000 people being killed. It's a lot of people for that.
There are a lot of echoes here of other bigger policies, of Turkish policy, for example. Yeah. I mean, there were models for this, and they were all happening around this time. This is something that you see in Eastern Anatolia and the Caucasus. It's as if they took this naive idea that Woodrow Wilson brought to Versailles, that a nation is an ethnos. And they said, well, okay, then there's only going to be one ethnos in this nation, and it's going to be ours. And if there are any others, they're vermin.
Yeah, Wilson really did screw things up, didn't
yeah.
he? Shows what happens when you have a professor, I guess, as president, which we'll get to with Zvi Gamsakhurdia.
Right.
So, yeah, so they they burned 50 villages, forced tens of thousands to flee as refugees. Now, remember also, the majority of Ossetians live in North Ossetia. So, like, for example, today, South Ossetia has a population of, I believe, about 70,000, 80,000 people, the overwhelming majority being South Ossetians. North Ossetia has, I think about 450,000 Ossetians live there, I believe, is the population, yeah. So the overwhelming majority live in North Ossetia. And South Ossetia is a lot more rural. It's very pretty there. It's stunningly beautiful.
I looked up some photos of this because you expect war zones somehow to look bleak, because a lot of recent ones have been. But this looks like Lake Tahoe, the stuff I saw.
Yeah, again, it's kind of like Karabakh. I remember some of the photos of there. It's really beautiful. And it's then that drive down on the South Ossetian side, the Georgian side, from the Roki Tunnel down into Skhinvali, the capital. It's amazing. It's stunning, these valleys and gorges and high, sharp mountains. You know, the mountains there, in that general region, their mountains go up to 15,000, 18,000 feet high. They're among the tallest. They're certainly the tallest in what's called Europe. So I want to read another thing again, just to get this through to people. And here's what British journalist C.E. Betchhofer said of British-backed Georgia. He said, quote, "I am sorry to say that the record of the Georgian government in its 2 years' existence in the Transcaucasus has been marred by nearly every fault that a state can commit. Chauvinism has run riot." And that's a Brit at that time, saying that.
Saying something about a regime that was convenient because it opposed the Soviet Union, which was Satan at the time.
Yes.
So that, it must have been pretty awful for him to be forced to say that.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So the Bolsheviks overthrew the Mensheviks, the Bolsheviks from the north, from Russia, overthrew the Georgian Mensheviks in 1921, established Soviet Georgia in 1922. So almost immediately they granted South Ossetia an autonomous region status within Georgia. And this is really important. This sounds like something from a board game, unless you really understand how it works. But when you have this autonomous region, you get a lot of perks. You do get some local control. You do get your minority assured that it gets a lot of elite positions in government, in the allocation of funds.
There's a story you'll hear from all over the world, it tends to go along with getting that sort of status, which is, if you don't have that kind of status and you don't speak the majority's language, your first day at school means getting hit with a belt the first time you say a word in your language. If you've got that kind of autonomy, then maybe you won't get hit with a belt the first time you say an Ossetian word rather than a Georgian word.
Right. No, that's absolutely right. Despite all that killing and bad blood, the Soviet Union did put a freeze on all of this. And both being Christian, I guess, the South Ossetians really intermixed quite well over the course of time in the Soviet Union with Georgians. Half the families were mixed marriages in South Ossetia itself, between Georgians and Russians. And Georgians lived there even after the wars of 91, 92. Most Georgians, and there were still tens of thousands, still stayed there because they were able to still get along with the Ossetians. It was really only the 2008 war that they were kicked out for good. And this is
one thing we should mention, though, that I'm not sure everybody understands, is that Georgians did pretty well in the Soviet Union.
Oh, yes.
There's a great passage in Limonov's Memoir of a Russian Punk, where he's sitting there trying, you know, in this, in Saltykov, which is like hell on earth, housing project in Kharkov, or Kharkiv, if you prefer. And he says to himself, how come the Georgians do better than the Russians? After all, we conquered them, not the other way around. And the Georgians seem to have had a real knack for running the kind of operation that could make you money in Soviet conditions. So they weren't one of the... Stalin made a point of coming down hard on Georgian cultural chauvinism just to prove he wasn't favoring his own people. But they definitely weren't one of the big losers, one of the persecuted peoples of the Soviet Union.
No, quite the opposite. You're right. And again, people who were there in like the 80s talked about how well they lived. And in the books you read now, they all talk about that as well, that the Georgians and a couple of the Baltics, the Georgians lived at the level, at least, of sort of the Estonians and Lithuanians, and lived better than the Russians, and they did. And that was, I think, part of their arrogance as well, and gave them this idea that, damn, we're doing so well here, let's blow these losers off. Think about what we could do if we could, if we break free. They were talking about they'd be the second Switzerland, I think is what one of the...
it's easy to understand that. Like, look at the conditions we're dealing with. Like, you know, if we could only play the Roxy, we'd wow them.
Exactly. So that was the situation in 88, 89, when nationalists, the first nationalist stirrings start to happen. Georgia doesn't realize it, but it has a lot to lose, and it does lose a lot. I mean, its economy collapsed something like 80-90% over the next 6-7 years from all the wars and the damage and the insanity that went on there. The person who, you know, they're George Washington, I guess you call him, is this really strange, weird, and absolutely fascistic loon poet translator named Zviad Gamsakhurdia. He was a well-known dissident. If you go back to archives, you'll actually see him, you know, written up in the 70s. He founded Georgia Helsinki Watch. He was an amnesty guy, I think, for Georgia in the 70s. He was agitating. His father was a famous Georgian novelist. He was agitating for Georgian, you know, independence and for Georgia's culture and language going back to when he was a kid.
Well, the part that blows me away is he translated T.S. Eliot into Georgian.
And Ginsberg. And
Wow, Ginsberg.
Yeah. And Ferlinghetti.
Oh, man.
Baudelaire. He was most, I think, best known in Georgia for his Baudelaire translations as well. Yeah, I mean, this is the weird thing. So when they go, when we saw a bit of this in the Azerbaijan-Armenia wars and who was leading them in the early days. You know, there were a lot of poets,
right?
Particularly on the Armenian side, as I
mean, having wasted decades of a very foolish life on poetry in America, I find that almost impossible to believe, and I gotta confess, sort of enviable. I mean, yeah. That to confess yourself a poet in the U.S., you know, it's like the old joke, oh yeah, what restaurant do you work at? I mean, it's like it means you're a loser. And it didn't mean that in those places.
No, I mean, that was one of the things that blew me away. The first time I went to Russia, the Soviet Union, in late 1991, and I would tell people then that I was writing and starting to be a writer and wanted to be a writer. And it was the first place where people didn't laugh at me. They looked at me like I was a banker or something in this country. Like, wow, you're going to go places. You know, it was, they really respected writers in a big way. And that rug just got pulled out, you know, like in a trap door in January 1st, 1992. But it was definitely a big thing throughout that period. And you know, when Perestroika started, the intellectuals and the poets and the artists were the only ones who really had ideas. Everybody else had been kind of frozen, you know.
Yeah, so this guy was second generation elite, right? Yeah. So Gamsakhurdia had tremendous confidence.
Yes.
I, I can imagine he was welcome in any place that mattered within Georgia, and a lot of places in Russia too.
And he had Western friends, and he'd been written up in the New York Times. So he was arrested in a big way in 1977, along with other Georgian, nationalist, independence, human rights activists, when they did another one of their sort of sweeps and crackdowns on the human rights movement in the Soviet Union. He was arrested along with his, school buddy, who I think was a sculptor or something, and they were put in jail. And then Gum Sakhordia gave a videotaped confession, which a lot of Georgians never quite forgave him for. And it was shown on Soviet television, in which he said, "Yes, I recant." I think he even ratted out some people.
Yeah. He also has a very impressive look. He has that steely-eyed stare that Erdogan has too, and that's popular in those countries. This is part of the world where not all politicians have to smile all the time. Although, as I recall, Saakashvili, maybe from his American experience, was a smiler.
Yeah, no, he is. He's kind of half Americanized. I like this one quote describing Gum Sakhordia in the 80s. His sad eyes and deathbed pallor were alarming, as though the man hadn't seen sunlight in years. It's sort of like a vampiric zombie version of Erdogan. He does look like Erdogan, though, you're right. Same mustache and hawk-looking face, kind of. Right, so he got it. He basically confessed and got out of prison, Soviet prison, in 2 years. In 87, 88, he starts leading very, very chauvinistic nationalist movement. And there's essentially like a competition. You can see how this would build fast. There'd be sort of like moderate independence people. And you start saying, no, this guy's a collaborator. He's giving into imperialism. We have to defend the nation. Well, I mean, you could see how in that mood, when there's this complete breakdown, that the more radical and extreme you are, the more power you're going to get from crowds. And that is what happened with him.
Right.
Before I go through the timeline here, I just want to read so that you get an idea of who Gum Sakhordia is. This is from an article I found. I had remembered that he was known as a total loon, but you can't really find much on him. And it's so I went and found an old article from 1991 from Scott Shane in the Baltimore Sun. I think Shane is now with the New York Times. And the headline is, "Nationalist Leader in Soviet Georgia Turns Georgians Against Minorities." And here's a quote. A Western diplomat said, "He's a scary person. His positions border on fascism. His statements are getting more and more outrageous." And then a liberal in Moscow says, "All his talk about the Georgian nation has a brown shirt feel to it." He called in June of 1990, Gum Sakhordia, the leader of the Georgian independence movement, called mixed marriages between Georgians and minorities, quote, "fatal to the Georgian family and the Georgian language." And to an American journalist, he accused Azerbaijani and Ossetian residents of, quote, "stamping all over the native Georgian population's rights, threatening Georgia's territorial integrity and the lifeblood of our citizens."
And that's a real change because, as you said, until a decade earlier, half the marriages in South Ossetia were between Georgians and Ossetians.
At that exact point when he said that, half of them were. Yeah. So they were very integrated. Also, the majority of South Ossetians lived in different parts of Georgia, not in South Ossetia. So there were like 60, 70,000 in South Ossetia and then 100,000, in some of the big cities, I think, in Georgia, and in mixed marriages. And he's really going after them. And at one point, so he goes to one of the main provinces and historical provinces of Georgia, Kakheti, and he gives a speech and he says, "Kakheti has always been a very demographically pure region where the Georgian element has always dominated and always wielded power. Now things have taken shape there in such a way that we are wondering how to save Kakheti. Tartardom is rearing its head there and measuring its strength against Kakheti. There are Leks in one place, Armenians in another, Ossetians in a third place, and they are on the point of swallowing up Kakheti." This is the kind of talk he was doing.
I'm trying to make ethnic sense of that, and how the Armenians form part of Tartardom, I can't even imagine.
Exactly. And I think, kind of the crazier it sounds, the more it appeals. And what's interesting is over time, Gum Sakhordia winds up really being, it's again like the Erdogan blue state, red state thing. The Tbilisians eventually turn against him. And he eventually busses in all kinds of, all the provincials love him. And that's who he appeals to. You know, you see this with this kind of populism. So the nationalism is building. And so in Abkhazia, they're getting very worried. In South Ossetia, they're getting very worried. And in March of 1989, the Abkhaz convened and they said, we've got a big problem with Georgia. Their nationalism is going crazy. We need to get out of Georgia now. And when they did that and the news broke out, Gamsa Kordy and the nationalists went crazy. They brought, you know, busloads of ethnic Georgians into Abkhazia to scare them. There's a little bit of fighting. Then they went back to Tbilisi, held big demonstrations for Georgia and Georgian nationalism. This is April of 1989. And the Soviets, Moscow, decides to order troops in to quell the protests. And this went really bad. They put up barricades, the Soviet troops did, and they used conscripts, of course. And in the end, there were stampedes. There's a question over how they were killed, but apparently most of them, I think 19 were killed, hundreds wounded. Most of them were suffocated in a stampede. But at least one was killed by sharpened shovels. He heard for a long time afterward they were all killed by sharpened shovels. I didn't realize that was more of a kind of a rumor. One of them might have been, though, but a lot of them were asphyxiated from the bad tear gas as well. It was ugly, and now they had their martyrs. And so they held demonstrations after that and said, the Georgians did, and said, we need to go free now. And so in September of 1980, in August of 1989, the Georgian Supreme Soviet passed a language law, making Georgian the only language allowed in the public sector across all of Georgia, including its provinces. So South Ossetia.
Yeah, that's that moment that you hear about from minority regions all over the world where you start getting the belt for speaking the wrong language in school. And that's when things start to go really bad.
Yep. So South Ossetia passed a law making Ossetian the official language within South Ossetia. And then they called it the Battle of the Laws. And then the Georgian parliament would ban that law within the autonomous region of South Ossetia. Then in September 1989, Gamsa Kordy goes to the Central Committee in Moscow and demands that the Soviet Union grant Georgia the right, because they always have so many special privileges, the right to have their own ethnic army to regulate its internal ethnic problem, as he called it. And he didn't get that, yeah.
And they went along with that?
No, they didn't get that, no.
Okay.
So this is where, this is where you start to get these paramilitaries. Mkhedrioni, the knights, one of the first major Georgian nationalist paramilitaries, comes out of this because they wanted their own paramilitary to keep their ethnics in line or kick them out. In November 1989, South Ossetia passed a law making it a sovereign republic. And then that month, 30,000 Georgian demonstrators were mobilized by Gamsa Kordy and bussed into the South Ossetian capital, Skhinvali. The Soviets tried to stop them. The South Ossetians started forming their own self-protection militia. There were skirmishes. Things are still heating up more and more. Then we get to 1990. March of 1990, Georgia's Supreme Soviet declares sovereignty and nullifies all treaties with the Soviets and reestablishes legally the Menshevik Republic of 1921. And so the Abkhaz Supreme Soviet immediately declared itself a completely sovereign republic and asked Moscow to make it a republic in the Soviet Union. And then August 1990, Georgia is going to hold elections for its parliament that year. So they passed a law just before the elections that barred any party that was regional in nature, i.e. ethnic or regional in nature. So you had to be a national Georgian party to even participate. And Gamsa Kordy came out and said, also before their independence referendum, anybody who doesn't vote for independence will not get citizenship and is considered a traitor and an enemy of the country. So things are getting worse and worse and worse.
Democracy is rearing its ugly head.
Yes, exactly. So in October 1990, they hold the elections. Gamsakhurdia's party, the Round Table Bloc, wins power. He becomes speaker in a kind of parliamentary republic. And he
the
takes
Round control. Table. That's a very odd echo of the whole King Arthur business, but all
yeah.
right.
Yeah. The next month, South Ossetians hold elections, and Gamsakhurdia immediately declared their elections invalid. He abolished the South Ossetia's autonomous status, declared a state of emergency, cut off electricity, imposed a blockade. He renamed South Ossetia after the two big cities. He called it the Skinvali and Java regions. It's the second biggest town is called Yava or Java. And fighting immediately breaks out. And there's on and off fighting over the next 2 years, 91 to the middle of 92. And about 1,000 people die total out of 70, 80,000 people. So that's a lot. Gamsakhurdia sent in, shortly after declaring the state of emergency, sent in 5,000 Georgian militiamen and National Guardsmen into Skinvali. And the first thing they do is they attack all the locals and they completely loot the place. Meantime, we have this major paramilitary group that becomes one of the power sources called the Imhedrioni, the Knights. And I just want to talk about this really quickly. These guys wind up wielding power, and they eventually overthrow Gamsakhurdia. It's essentially a giant criminal gang. They have their own outfits. It's sort of like part knights and part gangster with sunglasses and, sport coats and all that stuff. And they're led by a bank robber and former Vorva Zakon thief-in-law turned playwright. There's another one of these named Yaba Yoseliani. It's kind of amazing. He went to study at Leningrad University in the late Stalin era. He didn't complete. And then he tried robbing a bank in 1948. It would be a scary time, I would think, to try to rob a bank.
Yeah. Yeah, you really, really don't want to mess with Stalin's law enforcement agencies.
No. And so he gets sentenced to 17 years prison, gets out, and then he's in prison again in 1965 for manslaughter. Somehow gets out, and, talk about second and third chances. And after he gets out, he goes to the Georgian Institute of Theater Arts. And you got to understand, again, the arts in Georgia are a very big deal, and they were in the Soviet Union, too. A lot of their best, most famous and beloved, film directors and playwrights and so on, they were Georgian and artists. So he goes to this Institute of Theater Arts and he becomes a professor there and a playwright. And then when everything starts falling apart, he becomes the leader of a criminal paramilitary group called the Knights, Hedrioni.
Wow, sort of literary criminal overlap is something you don't really get so much in our culture. But
not at all.
The mono of you, see how the dreams intermingle, and the career choice is actually a difficult one. Do I go for the gangster thing, or do I go for the avant-garde poet thing?
That's true. Yeah, in Memoir of a Russian Punk, those are the two big choices for a man: poet or gangster. Yeah, and those are the ones that the girls go for, one or the other, right? The Mkhedriani, they wind up, among other things, they control the entire gasoline racket in Georgia. And Yoseliani doesn't like Gamsakhurdia. From his point of view, Gamsakhurdia is one of these physically weak, weak-kneed intellectual types that he has complete contempt for. And eventually, Gamsakhurdia puts him in prison. Gamsakhurdia realizes he's a threat. And in March of, it's February of 1991, Gamsakhurdia outlaws the Mkhedrioni, jails the leaders, and sets up his own Georgian National Guard that will be answerable to him. And then in March 1991, there's the Georgia independence vote. They vote overwhelmingly for independence. He tries sending paramilitaries back into South Ossetia, gets repelled again. August 1991, August 1991 is when the coup against Gorbachev takes place, the sort of three-day coup.
Right.
And this is another weird moment for Gamsakhurdia, because remember, he collaborated with the KGB to get out of jail in the late 70s, and this is always a black mark on his record. He collaborated to get out of jail early, and in August 1991... when the coup was initially announced, and this was a KGB coup, he immediately disbands his National Guard and he tells everybody don't demonstrate, and he basically falls into line with the coup plotters. Who knows what? This has never been explained, but it just raises more questions about this guy, you know, in general. I don't know what.
Yeah, maybe he thought he'd have a better deal if the old order were reestablished.
Yeah, it could be that. Or maybe he knew these guys really well and thought,
right,
you know, these are the guys I'm not going to mess with. These aren't the South Ossetians. Can't kill them as easily. Yeah. I don't know what was going on in his head. But that did weaken his power, the way he acquiesced for a lot of people, and especially in Tbilisi. They really turned against him. That was sort of one of the last straws. And they kind of woke up from this nationalist fever, particularly in Tbilisi, the intellectuals and so on, at that point realized who they were being run by. So in September, you have this opposition rally against Gamsakhourdia, against his dictatorship, and it ends with Gamsakhourdia's own forces firing on demonstrators and shooting, killing and wounding them. And that really shocked a lot more people, created huge opposition against him.
And so these were fellow ethnic Georgians?
Yes, fellow ethnic Georgians. That's what shocked them so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, again, Gamsakhourdia realized, first he called them all agents of the Kremlin. He said that the opposition protests were all engineered by the Russians. You see this now with Poroshenko. You see this over and over, that stuff that has a local character, even if the Russians are involved, they're genuine local grievances. Genuine local grievances being carried out. The Russians may or may not be manipulating them, but they're real. Just like the Maidan Revolution had a very real, whatever you say about American involvement in it, the grievances were very, very real.
Yeah, I mean, both the great powers of the 20th century tried often enough to get something going when there weren't enough real grievances, and it never worked. There had to be some basis that was local for anything real and sustainable to get started.
Well, on top of it, I think at this time the Russians were, there was so much chaos. I mean, in September of 1991, there was just a scramble at that time. I don't think anybody knew. The whole Soviet Union was falling apart, and in fact, it was going to be dissolved in 3 months. So I don't think the Russians were really manipulating things. I think it was almost entirely local at that point.
Right.
But Gamsakhourdia called them all traitors, bandits, Russians, blah, blah, blah. Again, Saakashvili will do this when he faces demonstrations as well. And then to divert everyone, he again sends paramilitaries into South Ossetia, and they're repelled. And December 1991, the leaders of the Mkhedrioni, including Yossi Eliani, escaped from prison. As things get more and more, deteriorate more and more, he escaped from prison. He joined with Georgia's National Guard, who had also turned against Gamsakhourdia. There were street battles in Tbilisi. 100, 200 people were killed. They drove Gamsakhourdia out. He fled to Armenia. He would eventually come back and try to retake power again. But he's out, and then suddenly the country is run by literally a triumvirate of bandits, led by Yosliani, and then the head of the National Guard, which is really just a rival bandit group. And they decide, first of all, to, rather than fight each other, to divide up the rackets. So the National Guard is going to take all the arms trafficking and other rackets. The Mkhedrioni are going to take the gasoline trade, very lucrative, and other business rackets. And then they decide we need somebody up top, you know, to unify the country. So they bring Edward Shevardnadze, kind of one of the godfathers of perestroika, back.
Who had been Soviet foreign minister in the late stages of the last stages of
exactly.
the
Soviet. Soviet foreign minister. And he led the Soviet Georgian Republic in the 70s when they put Gamsakhourdia in jail.
Right.
So for a while, he was hated and considered a Russian agent and all that kind of stuff. But I think at this point, enough Georgians, especially in Tbilisi and the big cities, were so sick of the nationalism that they were happy to have Shevardnadze back. And one of the first things he does is kind of interesting, is he gives a televised address, I believe it was, in April 1992, apologizing to South Ossetia. And here's a quote. He says, "It seems to me that the Georgian people cannot wipe away from itself this stain of bloodshed for many centuries."
Wow. It's one of those odd moments of sanity where you start to think of the norm as complete screeching madness.
Yeah. And he's trying, Shevardnadze is trying to get Georgia admitted into the UN, and they're not admitted yet because they have these major internal border problems. And generally the UN wants borders to be fixed before they let in a new country. In May of 1992, after Shevardnadze gives a speech, nevertheless, a whole wave of Georgian irregulars starts attacking the Ossetians again. And in one attack on a convoy of South Ossetians going into North Ossetia, Georgian irregulars killed 36 civilians, mostly women and children. That led to huge demonstrations. And then May 29th, 1992, South Ossetia formally declared independence. In June 1992, the North Ossetians, against surrounded army garrisons, got all kinds of weapons from the Russian army garrisons, howitzers, trucks, weapons. You got to remember also, the Ossetians are very well respected and liked by the Russian military elite, and that goes back some time. But even, I think, if I'm not mistaken, per capita, more Ossetians died in Second World War than I think any other peoples.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. And that war is still obviously a subject of deep, deep reverence.
Yes.
And I think at that moment, anybody in the Western agencies was busy saying, you know where the nukes are? Can we buy some nukes from you?
Exactly.
So I don't think they were too worried about who was selling a few conventional weapons to Ossetians. No.
So after the South Ossetians formally declared independence in June, the Georgian National Guard attacked Skhinvali again. They destroyed and burned 80% of the city, killed 500-600 Ossetians, it was, that one is remembered. Some of the ruins, when I went there were a lot of ruins. Ossetians in Skhinvali still left some of the ruins from the 92 battle. They drove them out, the Ossetians did, with this new equipment and the North Ossetian volunteers. They drove the Georgians out, and Shevardnadze pretty quickly agrees to a ceasefire deal with Yeltsin. We're seeing here the early part of how a frozen conflict, like we're seeing in Donbass now, how it actually transpired. And it's important to keep in mind because there's this talk now, it's almost as if Putin is responsible for South Ossetia, for Transnistria and Moldova, you know, for the Donbass region. Like, these go back to Yeltsin's time. And Yeltsin and his people, Pavel Grachev, especially his defense minister. I mean, Yeltsin put on a good show for us because he was never threatening to us. And so we let him get away with it. Now we're acting like not since Hitler's time has any country gone and carved out pieces of another country before. This all started under Yeltsin, and it was based on genuine local grievances. And whether it's right or wrong is another question, but that is how it started. So that's where we left it off. Shevardnadze does the peace deal. That allows him to bring Georgia into the UN, which is a big deal for him. And I don't know, from this point, I mean, we'll talk very briefly maybe about Abkhazia, because this is where things turn to next. And Abkhazia always mattered a lot more to the Soviet elite, to the Russian elite. Abkhazia is the, as you said, the top of the mouth of the Georgian bite on the eastern Black Sea. But the capital of Abkhazia is a city called Suhumi. Now, you've probably heard of Sochi because of the Olympics. Sochi is about 10 miles from the border of Abkhazia. Suhumi was always the Black Sea town for the Soviet elite, going back to Stalin's day. It was always known as beautiful. I think Lomonov wrote about the mandarins from Suhumi and Abkhazia, the beaches there.
Yeah, it's on the Russian border. They love the place. It's got a coastline. It had, as far as I know, always been loyal. Yeah, sounds like the place you stand up for.
Right. In August of 1992, this is right after Georgia gets the UN, they get allowed into the UN. They've closed the peace deal with South Ossetia. And at this time, the supporters of Gamsakhurdia, because he's from Mingrelia, I think it's called, it's one of their sub-regions, I guess, of Georgia, more in the west, they're angry. He was popular in the provinces, popular with the Hicks. They're trying to fight back and overthrow Shevardnadze. And at some point, the supporters apparently kidnapped Georgia's interior minister and a member of parliament and supposedly brought them inside the border of Abkhazia. And so the Georgian National Guard under Shevardnadze sent 5,000 troops to get to supposedly to free the interior minister, the kidnapped interior minister. They crossed in the border of the Abkhazians, were taken by surprise when they realized there was very little resistance. The Georgians went straight to Suhumi from there and completely sacked the city, looted it, pillaged it, and then landed another force in Gagra, which is a bit north of Suhumi, and did a pincer and took control and went on TV and said, "This is ours now." And the military commander said, "I can assure those separatists that if in round numbers 100,000 Georgians die, then all 97,000 of yours who support the decisions of Ardzinba," this is the Abkhaz leader, "will also die." So basically he was saying, you're all going to die if you send it. He said, there will be no prisoners taken. And
this is a very rough way of reminding them, you are a small people. We can do with all of you.
Yeah, and remember, so the Abkhaz are a minority there. They're a minority even within their republic, and that has to do with, especially under Stalin, how Stalin helped Georgianize the population. So whereas the Abkhazian were a majority in the early part of the 19th century, I'm sorry, the 20th century, when the Soviet Union was first founded, by 1989, the Abkhaz were something like 18% of the population. They were the leadership positions. But they were only 18% of the population. Ethnic Georgians were the largest component. They were 48% or 46% of the population. There were a lot of Russians, Armenians, Greeks, and others. So the Georgians come in there, and the way the Abkhaz fight back is, I mean, they're related to a lot of these Caucasus people, is they convene basically a peoples of the Caucasus, the North Caucasus meeting, and ask for help. And the main contingent, the main fighting force that gets its training for future battles is Shamil Basayev's Chechens. Shamil Basayev being the fearless and bloodthirsty leader of the Chechen resistance, he leads his forces in, he takes back Gagra. They wind up taking a lot of Abkhazia back except for Suhumi. Suhumi itself is not taken until September of 1993. So it takes about a year for them, with a lot more Russian help, to take it back. And I remember, and that was really bloody. So about 10,000 people died in that war. And when the Abkhazians, with their Russian backers and Chechen backers, took control of Suhumi, they expelled all the Georgians, ethnic Georgians, 240,000 of them. And that became, they were everywhere. I mean, when I visited Georgia several times, you would see certain hotels in Tbilisi, and everyone would say, yeah, that's where the refugees from Abkhazia live. So they made sure you remembered it too. And, you know, in a small country, 250,000, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, and refugees like that often become the most embittered nationalists of all.
Yes. But you shouldn't be, I mean, when the Georgians, and this doesn't speak of the locals who live there, but definitely the Georgian military people who went in and took it, they were really horrible. I mean, even Human Rights Watch, again, which would always try and find a pretext to, you know, to slant things against the Russians, and with, you know, with plenty of reason a lot of times. But their report on how the Georgians behaved, first of all, one thing the Georgians did is they went to the National Archive of this, you know, small people, the Abkhaz National Archives, and burned 95% of their historical archives and manuscripts and everything. They burned it to the ground. They shot people who kept trying to put out the fires, including ethnic Georgians who tried to help save some of it, and made sure that they were going to be wiped off the map.
And that's really interesting. Yeah. They want to destroy the records of the existence of a troublesome people.
Yes. Human Rights Watch, describing the Georgian occupation from 92 to 93, said described torture, murder, rape, abuse. The Georgians used sexual terror as an instrument of warfare, and blamed, quote, primarily by the Georgians. When they retook Suhumi, the capital, though, it was again spearheaded by the Chechens and Basayev. And the first thing they did was loot the place also. Yeah. And they couldn't be held back. And there was a report from that time, an American news report, where they interviewed one of the Chechen volunteers, and he said, quote, "We do not want to stay here, but we have a right to our trophies."
Wow, that's quite a quote.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, because those trophies are living human beings.
Yep.
Or at the time, living.
Yep. Yeah. Peace is brought. Yeltsin and Shevardnadze agree to a peace deal. 3,000 Russian peacekeepers are the main force. So again, it's a Russian-controlled, frozen conflict, as they call it. A lot of UN monitors. But a lot of people died there over the years. I mean, I don't think, first of all, the West didn't care. They only cared about Shevardnadze, really. They knew him as an old friend. Mm. On the other hand, I don't think any Westerners wanted to die there. And people did die there over the years. I think about 150 Russian peacekeepers over the next 15 years were killed, picked off over time. So it was a dangerous place. So moving forward, a major event happens, 1999. And that is the U.S. tried to get a U.N. resolution to authorize military force against Yugoslavia to protect Albanians in Kosovo. And they didn't get it. And so they decided unilaterally, NATO did, to wage war on Serbia to protect the majority Albanian population, bomb Serbia, which sent the Russians. It's really hard to explain how psychologically damaging this was for Russians who had really almost slavishly, no pun intended, adored Americans until this point.
Yeah.
And really.
Yeah, we were there at the time. And,
yes.
And I remember I mean, it wasn't exactly shock and awe. It was shock and rage.
Yes, no, exactly. And a sense of betrayal. Like, yeah. I remember a lot of them sort of thinking, all these nationalists and revanchist communists that we used to kind of laugh at and sneer at in the 90s. Now thinking maybe they were right about you. Like, we can't believe you're doing this, and this must mean you're going to do this to Russia at some point, because we have a similar situation in Chechnya or whatever. Like, they just couldn't believe we would do it and defy the UN and invade and then carve out an independent ethnic enclave, carve it out of a sovereign country. It really did. And at the elite level, it terrified them too. And, some say, some intelligence people have said, I don't totally agree with this, that Putin coming to power shortly after that was actually a coup, that essentially the FSB, the restructured KGB, after Yeltsin couldn't do anything about Kosovo, they said to him, you've got a choice. Either you make one of us your new leader, or we'll just overthrow you and do it ourselves, because that's it. That's the last straw. Like, the Russian state is now actually in mortal danger.
Right.
It did definitely help put Putin in power in a big way.
Yeah.
And I should point out that Hillary Clinton bragged at the start of the bombing that she was the one who urged Bill to bomb when he wasn't sure what to do. Then in March 2002, Shevardnadze is still in power. I've talked about this before. The U.S. Green Berets are invited into Georgia to clean out the Pankisi Gorge of alleged al-Qaeda. And this, again, I was in Russia at the time, and I went into Georgia in March 2002 when they brought the Green Berets in. This was greeted, with huge smiles and joy by young kind of neoliberal nationalists, the Saakashvili crowd that I met in March 2002. All they wanted was the Americans in one way or another. Everybody knew that there wasn't really al-Qaeda in the Pankisi Gorge. What there were a lot of Chechen separatist fighters who would go in there, move in and out across the border with Russia as they were fighting the Russians. And one of the reasons, first, this set off one of the few, panics in Russia among the elites, not the liberal elites, but certainly the security services elites. They were furious. They were angry, and they thought Putin had suddenly become weak. And Putin came out and publicly, and I'll never forget this, and he said, "It's not the end of the world. Let him." It was his judo thing, you know, where he knew that he didn't have a strong hand, he couldn't do much, and he would play the long game on this.
Right.
And he was still very weak, still getting control over his own country. They were surprised because, if you remember, after 9/11, Putin was the first person to call Bush and to come out and back him up and to open up all the airspace for flights to Afghanistan and all kinds of intelligence. So the elite felt betrayed again, and they thought, you know, Putin's just turning out to be another Yeltsin. He's a naive
idiot. Yeah, not again. I can imagine that feeling.
They were furious, I can tell you. Yeah. But Putin's style is not bluster followed up by nothing. Mm. Putin's style is usually let the other people bluster, don't show your hand, and, you know, he's kind of a scary guy in that way.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing, though, is the U.S. Green Berets go in there and they train the Georgians, and they wind up, quote unquote, cleaning out Pankisi. You know, cut to today.
Cut to
all
Syria.
The leaders of Islamic State are from Pankisi Gorge. How did that happen? I mean, it's except Baghdadi, but I mean, the military leaders are from Pankisi. There are only 10,000 Kis Chechens there.
Yeah, Omar al-Shashani.
And his brother.
And his brother, right. Yeah. Right.
And then there's the, you know, the guy who's supposedly the Chechen who's behind the Istanbul airport attack and the Paris attack and who organized a lot of the attacks in Europe.
Oh, yeah. One-eyed Omar or something like that.
Yeah, one-armed.
One-armed. Oh, yeah. Right.
He spent a lot of time in Pankisi also. So it's, you know, it is weird. That's all you can say.
Yeah. Good job. Good job with the cleaning out.
Bang up job. I know. Or maybe it was from their point of view.
You know,
I mean, it's hard not to suspect that they think in the end the pluses and minuses, this always works out as giant pluses for us. And, you know. So anyway, so 2003, November, the Rose Revolution, which I also saw, Saakashvili is put into power. The Rose Revolution has a lot of U.S. backing. It's one of the first color revolutions that you really saw how it operated. I remember interviewing some of these guys. So they all have a big student element, right? And they're very branded. So I remember the Otpor people in Serbia. And granted, all young people, whether they were for neoliberalism or not, young people hated Milosevic when I was there, even the young Serbs in Kosovo, in the northern part of the Serbia. They did. They hated him. Why wouldn't they? Mm-hmm. And this youth group, Otpor, they had as their sign, it was like a black symbol stenciled, so it would be easily stencilable, this kind of black power fist, like people power fist. And I remember seeing that graffiti stenciled around like Mitrovica, the capital of northern Kosovo, the Serb part of Kosovo, and in parts of Belgrade, you'd see it, you know, spray painted around this Otpor fist. And in Georgia, when I was there for that revolution, they had their youth element, and all these guys had the exact same T-shirts and stenciled fist, the exact same
one.
Wow. And they called it Chimera, and the Chimera. Resistance, it's the same word as Otpor in Serbian, resistance. Mm-hmm. And I remember finally just asking some of these, they're young people, and they were out there like surrounding, apparently they wanted Shevardnadze to go, they declared vote fraud. And I was like, where'd you guys get these symbols? You know, who made this up? Who are you with? Mm. And they all told me they were students, and they got paid a few bucks. They were laughing.
Wow.
They were like, we're just here. The serious people were kind of running around in the shadows. And
right.
Cutting deals, but all the youth people were, at least the ones I talked to, there may have been genuine ones, but the ones I talked to who were in the front of the demonstration, they were all just like making a few extra bucks on the side, like, you know, a kid holding up a car dealership sign or something.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's one reason I tend to disagree with Thierry Marignac about the Turkish coup. They didn't have any symbols ready. They hadn't even picked a color scheme. It's just not that, not the style.
Yeah, I agree. We have the quasi popular coup thing down pretty well. Why we wouldn't do that? The only thing I can think of is, you know, that the Kemalists or whatever you call them behind the coup said, no, we're loved. You'll see. As soon as we have the coup, they'll greet us with flowers and cakes and, okay. But that just doesn't sound very plausible. We usually get this going for a while, you know. You build it up. You have NGOs and civil society, as we call it, building up grievances and heating things up before you actually, you know, strike. In any event, Saakashvili, immediately after taking power, holds an election and he wins 96% of the vote. He was genuinely popular. He was very charismatic. He was really ballsy in this thing. I mean, no matter how staged it all is, it's never fully staged. It wasn't. And you didn't know if Shevardnadze would fire on people. You know, he had armed troops out there. They just weren't sure what to do. And Shevardnadze, to his credit, didn't want to fire on them. Ultimately, he stepped down because he didn't want to kill people. And this is a difference between him and Saakashvili, by the way, and Gamsakhurdia. He wouldn't kill his own people. The thing about Saakashvili you have to understand is when he came to power, he was known as a nationalist before anything. And he always talked about taking back those territories. He had his own flag, which his party had a flag, which is now the flag of Georgia, which became the flag of Georgia, which has crosses on it, which when he then made that the national flag, you know, they do have a Muslim minority there. The Muslim minority got very nervous by that for obvious reasons. Suddenly the flag went from a tricolor to Christian crosses on it. He was known as the Zhirinovsky, the nationalist firebrand, very young, early 30s when he came to power. And he promised he was going to take back all the regions that weakling Shevardnadze couldn't take back. And his first visit in February 2004, his first overseas visit or, you know, foreign visit was to meet with Putin. And it's interesting to read because I think Putin had a big influence. I think he was always kind of wanted to be like a pro-Western Putin. He was giddy after his meeting with Putin. And he told his foreign minister, who then later told journalists, he said about Putin, he's a real leader, a resolute and strong man who controls everything, the Duma, the mass media, and so forth. And then he called his man in the Bush administration, Matt Breeza, gushed, you know, in the same way about Putin. And in their meeting, Putin said, they talked about the three regions. And Putin said, look, for us, the big problem is we don't want Georgia in NATO. That's a red line and that's a problem. So let's talk about other things that maybe we can resolve. And let's start with what we can. And he agreed if Saakashvili wanted to take back Adjadia, which is the port city of Batumi, and this is a Muslim Georgian region in the south with a wealthy port, Batumi, and led by Abashidze was his name. Anyway, the leader of that region was just a 90s style mobster. His son was the richest man in Georgia. I think he had like a kennel of 200 attack dogs that he loved to raise. One of these really eccentric types, not popular, of course, because he kept everything for himself. So Saakashvili,
Kadyrov without the charm.
Yes, exactly. And the other thing is, the leader of Adjadia was very close to Moscow Mayor Lushkov, who was an opponent of Putin's. So Putin really did not. They had a lot of business deals together. So as far as Putin was concerned, you know, it was a no-brainer. Go ahead and take it. I'll look good. I'll look like I can cut deals and give him something big. And I actually don't care if he was Adjadia, because Lushkov is the one who's going to lose a lot of business. About South Ossetia, he said, wait 12 to 18 months. Putin told Saakashvili, he said, if you wait on that, that'll give me time to start. You know, I mean, these are Ossetians. These are people who are nervous. They're, loyal. They're Caucasian. We need to give them a lot of comfort and bring them along. And Saakashvili agreed. Okay, great. So then in May, 2 months later, 2004, 2 months later, he retakes Adjadia. He did a kind of like another Rose Revolution thing. He brought all these people out, busloads of people, and they kind of moved in, you know, with some other symbol I can't remember. And the leader of Adjadia just got scared, realized no one was backing him, and he fled to Moscow. And he lives like in the, you know, where all the multimillionaires live, in the Dacha area. Barvikha, I think today is where he lives. Tons of money.
Okay.
So then Saakashvili does something odd. He decides, you know what? I did this all on my own. I don't need Putin.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to take South Ossetia now.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the first thing he does is he closes down this huge open black market, very famous in the Caucasus, the largest open sort of, you know, like Cherkizovsky Rina kind of thing in all of the Caucasus, called the Ergneti Market. And he does it to fight corruption, and that's very legitimate. But the problem is, this is where, you know, we talked about how Ossetians and Georgians still, even after that first war in 91, 92, they still intermingled a lot and they still got along okay because they did a lot of business at that market. And it employed a lot of people on both sides. So Saakashvili goes and closes it down. And when he closes it down, it means that the Ossetians have to start really looking north at that point.
Right, right. So, okay, so he's doing everything he can to drive them out of Georgia while getting ready to stomp on them if they try to leave Georgia.
Exactly. And ministers later talking, you know, through the years, and this is reported by DeWall and others, they talk about how already in 2004, Saakashvili and his security ministers already have maps and invasion plans on how to retake South Ossetia. They're giddy by taking back Adjadia, which Shevardnadze never could do. They're absolutely giddy with power. They think they kind of have an okay from Putin. They think he might be weak. He wouldn't do anything. And they're just, they've already got the plans. And then he starts doing another thing that year, which he formalizes in 2007, which is he starts to rehabilitate Zviad Gamsakhurdia, the loony fascist poet who's at this point dead and buried somewhere in Chechnya. But he starts to rehabilitate his reputation, Saakashvili does. And that's not a good sign, really, either.
No.
So, yeah, so then in August, and again, so August would be just 6 months after his meeting with Putin, not 12 to 18 months, he sends in Georgian forces into South Ossetia on an anti-smuggling operation, and a lot of people get killed. There's shooting, 17 Ossetians died, five Georgians died. Colin Powell rings up Saakashvili immediately and says, warns him, and this is one of many warnings he gets that he ignores, don't invade South Ossetia. We will not back you on this. Bad idea.
Yeah. This is when U.S. politics comes in, because up to 2006, you could count on the Bush-Cheney administration to back any insane operation you had going, really.
Yep.
And then they get humiliated in the midterm elections, and the relatively sane faction, let's say, in their administration starts to maybe get a little more cautious.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So the problem with that, too, is that it sets back any possibility of a deal. After that military move, it set, as local OSCE people said, it set everything back at least 10 years. Yeah. And the timing was awful, because just a couple weeks later, this is September 1st, 2004, is when the Chechens take the Beslan school in North Ossetia, and the hundreds of children get killed. And the Ossetians, and I can tell you from TV that eventually they wouldn't show anymore, definitely the press, the mothers of the children killed became their own force, political force, for several years after that. The Ossetians were furious. They absolutely blamed Putin for that. They felt that they'd been completely left to, you know, hang out to dry, that they weren't protected, that they were going to have to protect themselves, that the Russians did nothing for them, they did everything wrong, they don't care about them. And at that moment, DeWall argues, and you know, there might be a point, had Saakashvili, rather than closing down and sending in military that summer, just in that six-month period, had he just held his tongue, it's not in his nature, and done the other thing and tried to charm them.
Yeah. We'll protect you.
Yeah, and we're with the Americans, and the Americans are nice guys, and the EU will bring in money, you know, and you can't trust the way things work in the Caucasus, they could have. If there was ever a possibility, that was it.
Yeah.
But that's not what happened.
It's strange, because this guy is from what I remember of the way he was treated in the American press, he's like Mr. Adaptable Preppy, just as at home on a yacht in Connecticut or whatever, as back home in Tbilisi and
swashbuckling. They love that word swashbuckling.
Yeah, but they use that he sounds like a bonehead.
Yep.
I mean, he sounds like a really violent bonehead.
Yep. That's why I think he identifies with Gum Sakordia so much. He's a better educated Gum Sakordia, and he speaks the language of neoliberalism. But, you are who you are. He's a Georgian chauvinist and a hot-headed bonehead. And, one of the problems with Georgian forces, this was something that was talked about in their total failure in all of their separatist wars of the late 80s, early 90s, is that, every Georgian, and particularly every Georgian in any of these nationalist paramilitaries, every single one of them was a sculptor, an artist, a poet. None of them was none of them was a private. As they said, nobody was below the rank of colonel.
Oh, my God.
You go in. No, I published 6 books. You only published 5,
Reminds me of this British cartoon about World War I. Sir, we're down to our last poet.
All right, so we got a little cut off there. Let's pick up where we left off. And then in May 2005, and this is very important, George Bush comes to Tbilisi and basically anoints his best friend. And in return, Saakashvili and the Georgians, not only they name the highway, and I've taken photos, maybe I'll try and send this out. I've taken photos of myself next to these huge pictures of George Bush Highway with George Bush waving, the giant murals of Bush right there in Tbilisi. The main road from the highway, so that any American delegations will see it, was renamed George W. Bush Highway, with all these big, fawning photos of W. And W pledged his support and, basically anointed Georgia like their best friend in the world. And Georgia became the second largest contingent in the coalition in Iraq, in the Iraq occupation, after the U.S., this tiny little country. So, you could see why he started to think he was pretty important, on top of having all these neocons running around and building up, boosting his ego and telling him, we're going to take on the Russians here. You could see why a guy who's already a bit unhinged could.
And they were still, the neocons were still pretty high around 2006. It wasn't until after the midterm elections and the insurgency in Iraq really, really went bad that they started to lose a little of their confidence.
Right. So in May, and this is fairly important too, and so in May 2006, the defense minister, and he was like part of Saakashvili's more hawkish wing, Akruashvili, he said famously, if we fail to celebrate New Year's in Skhinvali, that is the capital of South Ossetia, on January 1st, 2007, that is 6 months from then, I will no longer be the defense minister of Georgia. at the end of that year, he was no longer the defense minister.
that's one of those things like, if you don't let me pull the pin on this grenade, I'll resign. It's like, well, here's a letter. You can just sign here.
Yeah. But the important things are, though, that this guy started to become very popular with opposition people. Number one. Number two, it's a reminder of how nationalistic and important nationalism and taking back by force, these regions, how important it was in Saakashvili's regime. This is not Shevardnadze's regime. Saakashvili is very, nationalistic, right-wing, hardcore neoliberal. I remember I met with, when he was the economy minister, Benikidze, Kaka Benikidze, huge guy. Billionaire from Russia, made a lot of money in Russia, then became the economy minister in Georgia. And I remember when I met him, he had all these sort of plaques on his wall. And I think it was like from the Heritage Foundation, how he had the highest score in the world for their labor policy, which is to say they made it, you can fire anybody you ever want to and do whatever you want with their wages and zero benefits. I mean, they went in, really hardcore neoliberal policies there. It's part of what started making Saakashvili unpopular, but
unpopular in Georgia.
But in Georgia, yeah.
But not with his friends on the Eastern Seaboard.
No, exactly. And, you know, and he became increasingly, the more unpopular he started getting, the usual thing, the more authoritarian he started getting, shutting down opposition media, you know, crushing dissent, the usual stuff. And then in the middle of 2007, we talked about that fascist loon, Ziad Gamsakhourdia, who really took a wealthy country and brought it to total ruin by starting all these wars. So his body was in Chechnya. He had either killed himself, there was some mystery behind it, in 1993, maybe he was killed. Anyway, his body was there. Saakashvili, who'd been wanting to rehabilitate him, got an agreement and brought his body to Tbilisi and held a big ceremony and interned him, Gamsakhourdia, in like a pantheon over, you know, Tbilisi is very mountainous. It's a very dramatic and incredibly beautiful city, actually. This big, steep, mountainous city. And he, I guess, put his pantheon at the top of one of these mountains overlooking the whole city. And Saakashvili hailed Gamsakhourdia as, quote, a great statesman and a patriot.
Wow.
That's, I mean, it's like, I don't think even Milosevic ever talked the sort of crazy fascist talk that Gamsakhourdia did. It's pretty nuts that he did that. But it also shows that what he's doing is reaching out to, I mean, part of his politics were based on getting the ultra-nationalist, the fascist, you know, base. Appealing to them. That's where Saakashvili comes from.
And with that kind of base, corpses are very important. The corpses, I think there's still a real belief in magic, and that magic resides in the corpses of your ancient leaders, the ones who you think agree with you anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point. So by the end of 2007, and this is maybe somewhat relevant as to why he thought he needed a military solution. In November of 2007, Saakashvili is facing protests, and they get bigger and bigger, and then he starts cracking down on some of his former allies, including the defense minister who resigned. He starts arresting these people, throwing them in jail. The former defense minister had to get political asylum in France. So the protests grew huge, and on November 7th of 2007, there were 100,000 people on the streets of Tbilisi. Now, just to give you a comparison, I was there in the Rose Revolution. The crowds never got larger than 10,000, maybe a little bit over 10,000. Crowds, and I saw the photos, 10 times larger than that, which is really amazing, against Saakashvili. Of course, this was never reported much in the press because it was against one of our allies, so it didn't get a lot of play. And Saakashvili, of course, blamed everything on Russians. Everything is the Russians. Everything is the KGB, FSB, Putin. He sends in his troops, his police force, which had been trained up by Americans and by the EU. They attack and really violently attack the protesters. They use these brand new weapons that we designed actually initially for Iraq crowd control. LRAD weapons. It's the first time I think they were ever deployed against, at least outside of Iraq. I don't know if you've seen these LRADs or these sound beams that make you kind of like curl up and vomit.
Wow. Oh, I've heard about those things. Yeah.
They're starting to use them now. I think they supposedly deployed them like at a couple of anti-G7 or G20 protests in America. It happened a couple times. But this is the first time people thought they couldn't believe it was happening. And the Georgian troops, they wore these, like, when they fired tear gas, these weird Mickey Mouse, like from the video game Half-Life, scary-looking, weird masks. And so this got a lot of play around. It was crazy. Then he declared a state of emergency. His police went into the opposition TV media. Now, again, Shevardnadze allowed the opposition TV to run. His police went in and violently smashed it up while on live television news broadcast and shut it down.
Wow. Bad democracy, but good TV, I bet.
Yeah. So during the state of emergency, he says, we're going to immediately hold snap elections for president. And, you know, obviously makes it harder for anybody to organize against him. And he actually, what's weird here is he actually had to steal the election to win in the first round. In the first round, he ran against an absolute nobody. This is early 2008. And the final results showed him winning 53%, so that means he didn't have to go into a second round. But this is against a nobody, and even Western observers agreed there was a lot of fraud. Now, he would have won in the second round, but it shows how far, you know, he definitely won 96% the first time around in 2003.
So to get away from the possibility of a second round, he has to win an absolute majority in the first round, right?
Exactly. And so they had to fudge it. He got 3% over 50%. So you can see how at this point he's starting to think, and you know, this is the last year of his dear friend George Bush in office, and you know, he doesn't know who's going to come in next. So you can start to see from his crazy point of view how he starts thinking, I need to do something, and I maybe need to do it now. And the Bush people get wind of this, and they've been watching him for a while, and they love him and cheer him and so on, but they can tell something's going to happen, and they're worried. And so in July 10th, 2008, so this is less than a month before Saakashvili launches the war, Condi Rice goes to Tbilisi and in private delivers a quote, severe warning to Saakashvili not to go military on South Ossetia or Abkhazia. He's actually doing a lot of feints as if he's going to do something in Abkhazia at this time. That's where people more expecting, but she's privately warned. And then, of course, publicly, she goes and says, we stand by Georgia and, you know, and their territorial integrity and their right to, and all this kind of stuff. And he just decides, you know, I'll take the public statement.
Which is absolutely crazy. I mean, if you get a public and a private message like that, you know, a child knows that it's the private message that matters.
I think one thing that also helps explain this really is the American neocon friends that he has around him. And some of these guys are thinking, okay, they're already getting ready. So there's a core Bush people who know they're going to be leaving at the end of the year, no matter what. But there's a whole neocon contingent that knows that they're going to be part of the McCain administration. McCain comes in. And I would not be surprised. You know, so he's got, Saakashvili has Randy Schoenemann, who's a lobbyist, as his main guy in Washington, D.C., Randy Schoenemann, pays him, you know, $1 million. I can't remember how much off the top of my head. Hundreds of thousands of dollars a month from the Georgian government. Randy Schoenemann is the top foreign policy advisor to McCain. So he's both the lobbyist for Saakashvili and McCain's senior foreign policy advisor. And then he becomes Sarah Palin's, he tries to teach her as well. Schoenemann is trying.
Yeah, quite a little few stars on the CV around that point, didn't he?
Exactly. So I would not be surprised if guys like Schoenemann were saying, "Don't listen to her. Don't worry about it. Don't listen to her. McCain will stand by you." Do you remember when the war starts? McCain immediately comes out and says, "We are all Georgians." That's his famous statement. We are all Georgians, and he would have militarily backed.
Wow, and he didn't mean Jimmy Carter.
No. So now we move forward. For a few days before August 7th, you know, there's increasing gunfighting. The Georgians start shelling. The Ossetians fire back. The Georgians take a particular height in South Ossetia. And then on the night on the evening of August 7th, after things get really bad, probably the worst certainly they've been since 2004, Saakashvili goes on television. And this is something I heard when I went down to North Ossetia and met with a bunch of refugees from South Ossetia. They all talked about this, how at 7 p.m. on August 7th, Saakashvili went on television and announced the unilateral ceasefire and said no provocation he would not respond to any provocation. The Georgians were pulling back. And there was not going to be any fighting. It was a unilateral ceasefire, and it was absolutely solid. And he did this on television. It was shown in South Ossetians. All the South Ossetians saw it. All the Georgians saw it. So 4 hours later, what he actually did is he moved all the Grad rockets and artillery into place. And then when everyone was sleeping, they bombed the shit out of Skinvali, the capital, and launched their kind of lightning blitz. At this point,
that's extraordinary. That's extraordinary. I mean, I mean, this is a rough part of the world, but to put a lie that blatant out there in front of the public, and one that is much more likely to affect ordinary civilians than whatever military planners the Ossetians have, who are likely to be a lot more cynical about it. That's just bizarre.
It is. I mean, I think they just figured we need to do whatever it takes to win and take this place. It is bizarre. What was going on in his head is really a big mystery. I think it's fair to question Saakashvili's mental stability when you look at everything. He's an
right.
It's what makes him charismatic and interesting and magnetic, but he's definitely got a screw loose, you know, he really does. And he wouldn't be the first Georgian president who did either, after we talked about Gamsakhordia and of course Stalin, the most famous of them all. So yeah, as I said, I had just come back to Moscow at that time. I got through the airport, no problem. I was just there to pick up my stuff and I was going to leave in a few days. And then the following morning, the morning of the 8th, I got news. I started getting phone calls and saw that, that Georgia invaded South Ossetia and that the Russians were freaking out and they were planning to move back in. They were planning to invade themselves, or they had already started to move some armored columns through the Roki Tunnel into South Ossetia by the morning of the 8th. The Georgians were saying that actually they had just been invaded for no provocation whatsoever, except that they were a Jeffersonian democracy whose existence threatened Putin's mentality. Threatened Putin. If it succeeded, it would threaten Putin. It was like this weird mystical explanation for why that seemed to make sense to a bunch of idiots. It doesn't make any rational sense. But
yeah, as opposed to the fact that they had just bombarded the big city of South Ossetia.
Yeah, so this becomes a big point of contention, and later the EU actually does its own, and the OSCE, I believe, they did their own reports, and they did lay most of the blame on Saakashvili for this, almost the overwhelming amount of blame, and called him a liar, basically, and said that, he shelled, it was way disproportionate. So what happened is, after he announces the ceasefire, there's a bit of provocation. Maybe, maybe not. That's what the Georgians said. They had a series of excuses. First, they said, well, after we announced this provocation, and I've read some of the transcript, he actually said, after he announced a ceasefire, he said, we're not going to respond to any provocation. And there may or may not have been some provocative gunfire from the South Ossetian side. I don't know. But then that became the excuse for why they did this massive grad, rocket and artillery shelling of the city, that they had been provoked. So that's already, lie number one. Then lie number two, so then that's why they said initially they went in. Then when the Russians crossed over, they said, oh, we're being invaded, and this is why we had to do this. We knew that the Russians were going to come in and invade, and so we had to do this preemptively, which also doesn't make a lot of sense. Then why don't you go to the Roki Tunnel, or why would you just bomb the hell out of a city and then run? None of it really made any sense.
Because as we've said before, the Roki Tunnel is the one route for ground troops from the Russian part of Ossetia into South Ossetia, but they didn't bomb it. They left it intact, and they thought that they could destroy the large city of South Ossetia without provoking a response. It's just, well, I mean, as an American, I don't have much room to talk about stupid military moves around the early 2000s, but that certainly ranks up there.
Yeah, it does. And, the other thing is, so then about 3 weeks after the war is over and the disaster and people are picking up the pieces, and the Georgians realize that people are starting to really question after the fever's died down, and they're starting to question, wait, what really happened there again? Some of this isn't adding up, And so they came out and said, we have a tape of South Ossetian border guards at the Roki Tunnel and South Ossetian irregular, paramilitary, whatever they are, talking to each other. And we had intercepted this at the time. And this is on the 7th. So this is before Georgia shelled Skinvali. This would be before this would be after he declared the ceasefire, but before, so between 7 at night and 11:30 at night, after the ceasefire and before they launched their attack on Skhinvali, the capital, they'd heard, and then they would play it for people, and I remember the transcripts out there that it was the South Ossetians saying, oh good, you know, all the Russian armor's coming in now. Oh, do you see it? Yeah, I see it. And so there's a whole transcript, and there's this kind of, it's basically fake, transcript of these guys talking about it coming through the tunnel, and they have it timed and all this stuff. And the Western press started running with it and saying, okay, now proof is finally here. And so Saakashvili is right. You know, the reason why they launched is because they had this intelligence from this taped conversation, that the Russians actually did invade the night of the 7th rather than after Skhinvali was bombed.
Again, even in military terms, even if we're talking an absolute amoral, all-out struggle, a Stalingrad thing, it makes no sense to shell the South Ossetian capital and that not destroy the tunnel through which the Russian forces will have to come. It makes no sense militarily.
Exactly.
Let alone
so there's I think I'm going to try and record this and put this into the show, but there's this great scene where a BBC, I think he's from Hard Talk, so you know those guys are pretty aggressive. Anyway, a guy's interviewing the interior minister, and the interior minister plays this tape for him and says, you see, we had this evidence, and this is actually why we attacked, because now we have to admit, okay, yeah, sure, we did attack Skhinvali, and we did all that, but this is why. And the guy says, well, if this was the reason why did it take you 3 weeks to release this recording? And they said the reason was because they had lost it. I swear, I'm not joking. Their dog ate it or something. So they said they lost it because they had so many recordings they couldn't find it. And the guy's like, I find this really incredible that the pretext for a war, a tape that you just misplaced it for 3 weeks. And the guy just kind of looked at him, nodding his head, and thought, what am I supposed to say here? You know?
Yeah, what are you supposed to say? Like, hey, you know how many takes it took us to get that plausible?
I know. Not easy to find guys with authentic South Ossetian, you know, accents. You may not tell the difference, but, you know, this is Shakespearean, if you knew. Yeah, so the Georgians looked increasingly like liars, the Georgians, Saakashvili and his people, anyway. You know, you start seeing stuff in the European press, like in Der Spiegel, just calling him straight up a liar. So let me go back again to my experience, though.
You were on the spot. This is great.
So in the morning of the 8th, you know, I start getting a lot of phone calls, some from some editors. I did something right away for The Nation. and then I was going to do something for Radar magazine, which was just about to close. But it was kind of like the spy magazine when it was still open. It was, you know, really good editors and a good place to write if you couldn't be with the exile. And they said, yeah, we'll send you down there if you can get in. And I said, okay, great. So I checked around to make sure that I could get into South Ossetia. I wanted to go in from the Russian side because what I was seeing right away was all of the Western reporting was bylined, datelined from the Georgian side, from Tbilisi or from Gori, the closest major Georgian city. They were all there, the whole press, everyone was there. That was on television, they were all there, and they were telling it from their side, and I wanted to see it from the other side. And I knew Ossetians, as I said earlier, our general manager at the exile in the early 2000s, he himself was Ossetian. No one was talking about it. The Western press, as far as they were concerned, the Ossetians didn't even exist. This was only a war between Georgia and Russia. Georgia's right. Is our guy, Russia's the bad guy. Ossetians they maybe weren't even a real people as far as the Western reporters were concerned.
Made the comparison with Palestinians before.
Yes. And yes.
Yeah, there was a lot of that rhetoric that there's no such thing.
Yeah, or it's completely invented, or the Kremlin just uses it and invented it, and, you know, these people otherwise were very happy, peace-loving. The usual stuff they say about Palestinians, you know. So I made a few calls. I went down there. And I went down there, I think on the 9th it was, so the next day. War is still very hot. The Georgians are still haven't been driven completely out, I don't think, of South Ossetia at this point. And on the 9th, when I get down to Vladikavkaz, Vladikavkaz is the capital of North Ossetia, where most Ossetians live, and it's inside of Russia. It's near Beslan. And I got there, and I met with some of my Ossetian friends' family, and they drove me out to a village closer towards the border where there were a lot of South Ossetian refugees, huge tent cities. Were thousands of South Ossetian refugees who had fled from the shelling, from the Grad rockets and the bombing were. And it was, I mean, it was brutal. It was heart-wrenching. A lot of kids, a lot of old people, women and children. People were furious. They were so angry. They were crying. You know, if you started talking to them, they immediately start crying and screaming, and they describing the Grad rockets raining down on them and how Saakashvili had lied to them. And the betrayal to them was just so overwhelming that all of them said, and I didn't understand what they were talking about until later, and I understood the whole timeline, that they said, we all believed that nothing was going to happen. I mean, there's always shelling, there's always provocations. This happens a lot. We get scared sometimes. Some people had already left. But when he went on television, and this is a rare thing, and said, we're declaring ceasefire, and we're not even going to respond to a provocation, we felt at least good enough to go to sleep that night. So we were in our buildings, in our beds, rather than in the basements, when the shelling and the Grad rocket started.
Yeah, and the Grad rocket is an MLRS. It's a multiple launch, multi-tube, unguided ballistic missile. So it's a saturation weapon.
It's a war crime. I mean, what he did, and, you know, he was called out for that by human rights groups. It's a war crime, what he did, and particularly lying, saying they're not going to do anything, and then firing indiscriminately these rockets that you described into the city, hitting buildings, hitting residential buildings. Yeah, it's a war crime by law anyway. But, you know, if you got good friends, it's not a war crime, I guess.
Right.
So they were very upset, and they described it, everybody, as shock and awe. They a lot of people, I guess, by this point in Russia, because of the Iraq War, learned this term, either the Russian version or even in the American accent, you know, the English version, shock, and usually some kind of like Russian variant of it. That's how they describe what the Georgians did. Blasting the hell out of the city, and then in the morning rushing in with their, with their forces, and they took the center of the city at that point in the morning. The other thing, though, that all the Ossetians were saying to me that I met is they were angry. They were really angry with the Russians. They felt, again, betrayed. And I kept hearing this throughout, you know, I was there, I think, till about the 12th, 13th or so, that they felt very betrayed, that the Russians weren't able to protect them when all this was going on. I mean,
This is not long after Beslan, right?
Exactly. It's not long after Beslan. You know, they don't understand why Russia, with its huge military might, was not able to even prevent this in the first place.
Right.
And it's a legitimate question, but that's what happened. And so they were angry about it. In fact, while even though the Georgians were saying the Russians poured through the Roki Tunnel with their armor on the morning of the 8th, which is somewhat true, it was really what most of them said there is you didn't really see the Russians for two more days after that. They didn't really occupy the city. What they did is, They were very slow about moving, and in fact, they got ambushed, and the commander of the 58th got wounded in an ambush as they were coming out by Georgians. So they didn't feel very prepared. So what they did is they sent in the scary irregulars. You know, we talked about Abkhazia, we talked about Shamil Basayev and the North Caucasus volunteers. It's basically the same people, but of course not Basayev and his people, but the Kadyrovtsi, as they call them. And so that's Ramzan Kadyrov's people.
Chechen collaborators with the Russians.
Exactly. Although I don't know how much they would describe themselves as that. These guys are also kind of half at war.
I wouldn't call them people. That if I was in the same room with them.
Exactly. They're in an accommodation that works for both sides, but I wouldn't say that the Russians necessarily control them. They just have a common interest, I think, is the best way to put it.
Okay.
And in this case, it would be money. And I'm sure these guys were paid a lot of money. And as I explained, I met a couple of them, and they were they're the scariest people I've ever seen in my life. without a doubt. So these guys are the ones who really came in and cleaned out a lot of Skinvali and got the Georgians out and fleeing in the first day and a half, 2 days before the Russians came in a big way, according to people on the ground. So I take a press pool. I go with whatever's there of the press pool, the very, very tiny Western press pool that's even interested in seeing the story from the Ossetian and Russian side. We go in an APC, what the Russians call BMP. You know, we have to all sit inside these things, very uncomfortable. We get in, and then there were a couple trucks that accompanied us with conscripts, with Russian conscripts, and there were a couple more APCs to protect. I mean, this was a hot war zone still, and there were ambushes on that road. As I said, there were Russian journalists who got hit in that ambush. And they didn't want, I mean, you know, the trouble you could get in if you're a Kremlin press pool guy and you get any Western journalist killed or injured. I mean, you know, they wanted to take all precautions. It's understandable. And you want to control their movements, too.
Right.
In any event, so we go through the Roki Tunnel. It's really long, this tunnel. I mean, it's 2 miles and it feels like forever, you know, in an APC column. Very smoky, dark, obviously. You're going through this, you know, really massive mountain. You come out on the other side, and it's all kind of downhill from there, and real, as I said, incredibly beautiful and dramatic, rolling green hills with sort of sharper cliff-edge mountains all around, and sparsely populated, very green. We head down, pass through some villages. You start seeing some houses burnt out as you get lower and lower down. Some of them are Ossetian villages. Some of them are the Georgian villages. It's one of the things that the Kadyrovsi, the Chechens who are with the Russians, Chechens and Ingush, who are with the Russians and acting as their advanced paramilitary, they went in and cleaned out the rest and ethnically cleansed the rest of the Georgians. They didn't kill them, as far as I know. As far as I recall, but they definitely destroyed their villages, old villages. You know, the Ossetians didn't do that to the Georgians, even after those earlier wars. They let them, nearly all of them, stay there. There were, I think, 20, 25,000 Georgians still living there.
Right.
But this war did. This war definitely ended that.
That part isn't surprising at all. The part that's surprising is that they didn't massacre the whole population.
They may have known and gotten
out. Maybe they had orders.
Yeah. Maybe. Well, I don't know if they would have listened to orders, to be honest. But I have a feeling that the Georgians got out, before these guys came in. I'm sure there were some killings, but there wasn't a massacre of any kind I've ever read about or heard about of the ethnic Georgians. But they were expelled, and it was brutal. So we get finally into Skinvali. And actually, what's also interesting, I should point out, I was one of the guys in our crew, in our APC, was this guy, Matt Siegel. He was a stringer for the New York Times. The New York Times had like 4 correspondents on the Georgian side, including C.J. Chivers, who, as I found out from others, he never disclosed. Chivers had been given an honorary Georgian passport by Saakashvili. From what I heard from very good sources, several of them, this gives you an idea of why there's so much positive coverage of Georgia, why people felt so personally, you know, interested in and emotionally tied to the Georgian cause through the media. I mean, you hang out with Saakashvili. Yeah, he's unbalanced, but he's a very charming guy. He can stay up all night talking, funny, toasting. I told you, you know, the Georgian story, walking through the restaurant.
Yeah.
And, you know, you do banyas with him, and you get an honorary, making you honorary citizen of, you know, and here's an actual, genuine Georgian passport. You come in anytime. You are a friend, you know.
Right.
So the two journalists I know of, and I heard there are others, Western journalists, that reported on this story, very friendly at first, were Chivers, who's a very good journalist, and Arkady Ostrovsky, who was either with The Economist or The Financial Times at that time. And they didn't disclose this. You know, I think it's really sleazy.
They both got these honorary passports.
Yeah. And they were had Georgian citizenship, essentially.
Wow.
And they did, you know, functionally, yes. Yeah. This is what I'd heard, again, from a lot of journalists, their fellow Western journalists who found it disgusting, who were very anti-Russian themselves, too, but they found that disgusting. So, so I was on the other side, and so the New York Times had its stringer, Matt Siegel, and all these guys were only interested in what happened to the ethnic Georgians in South Ossetia, because their editors were only interested in that story, because the editors were framing everything as innocent Jeffersonian David, Georgia versus Goliath Russia.
Right.
And so no one was interested in the South Ossetians, period, you know. So these journalists only wanted to go to a Georgian village that had been burned. The South Ossetian didn't exist. It's pretty strange, you know.
Did this come up when you were writing with these people?
Oh, yeah.
About this?
Absolutely. And you know, the New York Times would give – I mean, they would yell at the Kremlin's Fox guy, the Kremlin minder, like, we want to go to these villages. Like, well, we're going to take you to Skinvali. We don't care. We want to go to these villages. We want to be able to film it. We demand that right, you know. And
wow. So they don't want to see what happens when a salvo of Grad rockets hits an apartment building in Skinvali. They just want to see the Georgian villages.
They did, but their answers are like, well, there's already film footage of it. We already know about that. We don't really care. What we want to do is go in those villages, you know.
Right.
And that basically it's because of what their editors were telling them. And so he did on the second day divert some of the – he did divert the column now that I remember. Yeah, he did divert our column and did allow them to go to one of the villages. And he allowed them to, like, take pictures and stuff like that. But his attitude was, number one, we got to – you know, we have to protect you. And so we can't just go running around everywhere. We have to have a route that's predetermined, you know. And secondly, just like the U.S., just like everybody, you want to try and control the narrative as much as you can, because the Russians had no friendly coverage as it was anyway. And the
right.
idea that they were then going to provide the story of, you know, what happened to the much, much smaller ethnic Georgian contingent rather than what happened to the Ossetians is, I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, if a Western correspondent gets killed in a situation like that, it's going to be blamed on the guy you've already designated the evil Goliath of the story.
Yeah, well, and this Kremlin guy loses his job at best, you know, in the best case scenario.
Yeah.
So that's what I just saw of the Western press pool while this was happening. And anyway, my first day, so we went into Skinvali. They let us out. It was pretty amazing. I mean, every single building I saw was damaged, some destroyed. But every single building had pockmarks because Georgian tanks were also driving down the main streets and just firing into every single, you know, those big block Brezhnev era, you know, apartment block buildings.
Yeah.
And just bombing all, you know, hitting all of them in case there were any irregular South Ossetian irregulars in any of these buildings. They also shelled the Russian peacekeeping base and killed a lot of, I think it killed like 20, I have to go back through my notes, killed some like 25 Russians in their bunk beds, I think, you know. They hit them also in the middle of the night before anybody expected it. That really pissed off the Russians, too.
Well, it's pretty humiliating,
yes.
Okay? I mean, just because Saakashvili, this guy that your intelligent people must know is a loon, makes a promise that he won't attack doesn't mean that your army should be snoring when the attack actually comes. That's kind of a career ender.
Yeah. So, you know, the scene there was pretty amazing. I mean, I'll just never forget, there was this one Georgian tank that was sort of right at this big four-way intersection in Skinvali, which is a town of about, I want to say about 70,000 people, maybe. You know, small to medium-sized Russian city, more urban, not like, you know, the villages around. And this tank, you know, its treads are completely blown off. The turret had been completely popped, like the turret had been popped off, and part of it, like it was landed like in its side and wedged into the ground in, I think it was the, I want to say it was like the music college there, a building, and it was wedged on its side, the turret of the tank, like a, you know, like a cookie wedged into a ice cream scoop in a sundae, you know, like into the side like that.
And this is why public sculpture just can't compete. How could you compete with that?
I know. And, you know, there was a lot of this damage everywhere, and people wanted to come out and tell us a story, and everyone, again, is angry. And they're very openly talking how angry they were with the Russians for being late coming in.
But when the Russians did come, the results were pretty clear, right? The Georgian army, which had been boosted, as you say, as a David, small but powerful giant killer, just crumbled.
In any event, also, people are heightist or something, because let's remember, Goliath lost that fight. Anytime you say, okay, well, it's David, you're the winner then. You know, you're the Goliath is the underdog.
Right.
It's kind of, it's a little flaw in that analogy. But in any event, that didn't happen for Georgia. I think it was the same thing. And I heard this then from Georgians afterwards when I talked to Georgians, like, Georgians don't like fighting. This is what they all said. It doesn't matter how much training the Americans give. It doesn't matter if we go to Iraq. It doesn't matter what we do. Georgian men don't like fighting. They like giving toasts. They like charming people. They like chasing women. They love to talk. They love to party. They love to be officers. They love to lead, but nobody wants to fight, and they can't change that. That was like the way that they summed up what happened.
And when you think of that, it's easy to see why they did so well during the Soviet era, when schmoozing was such a key skill. But in all-out war, it's not going to help you much.
Right. So then we got up from this area where there was sort of these tanks, destroyed tanks, and then they took us for a further tour of the city of Skinvali, and there were still a lot of Georgian troops, bloated corpses on the ground. You could smell that, you know, that sour smell of decomposing bodies. It was all over the city. There was still smells of smoke around as well in the city. It was quite dramatic. And I have to say, like, it any war course, this is, I mean, I saw a lot of violence in Russia and a bit in Kosovo too, but I hadn't seen an actual battle scene like this. And at the time that I was there, the Russians were busy, were just pushing into Gori, which is about 10, 15 miles, I think, outside of the border of South Ossetia, inside of Georgia, Gori being the birthplace of Stalin. Anybody who doesn't say that being in a war zone doesn't give you an incredible adrenaline rush, like pure crystal adrenaline, is lying. Yeah. I tell you, it took me several days, even after getting into Moscow, to calm down.
From what you say, it sounds like it was a one-sided battle for the city, that there weren't a lot of there wasn't a lot of Russian armor burnt out or a lot of Chechen or Russian corpses lying around.
No, basically what happened was, the way everyone described it, is the Georgians, when they were able to surprise the South Ossetians and target civilians, they did a bang-up job. They did a great job. They moved in. They took the city center. They were so excited. In fact, the Georgian commander had said that morning, and this is constantly being used against them, their excuses for the war. The Georgian commander went on TV, I think, and said, or told a pool of Western reporters, we are restoring constitutional order, and we plan on restoring this throughout the entire region of South Ossetia, and we're retaking the whole thing. This would, of course, go against their narrative later, but that's what he said. And they felt very arrogant. They felt very much in power, and they felt very arrogant because they did take the city, which was, you know, one of the two key assets there, the other one being the Roki Tunnel, which they didn't take. But as soon as the Russians came down, and as soon as the irregulars fought back when the Chechens and Ingush came in, they lost badly, and then they fled. And then they fled to Gori as the Russians came down in the Russian armor. And then as the Russians attacked Gori, they started with the air and then came in. The entire Georgian military completely melted at that point, completely. There was nothing standing. They didn't strategically pull back from Gori. They melted. They were gone. Wow. And there was a period of a couple of days from the 11th to the 13th. So you had all these American advisors, all these Westerners. Some American advisors I kept hearing had been with the Georgians on the initial night of the 7th through the 8th. Maybe they were contractors. I don't know.
my advice is not to run away. Hey, stop running away. Hello.
Exactly. They all had fled, and everyone was terrified for a couple of days. All the Westerners were holed up in the Sheraton Hotel. There was a lot of talk, should they evacuate everybody? The American embassy wasn't sure if they should evacuate. They didn't know what the Russians were going to do, because Saakashvili then was running around, and he believed it, but he was running around saying, the Russians are going to take Tbilisi. They want to conquer the whole country. That's the whole purpose of this. This is why they're doing this. Whipped himself into a frenzy, started chewing his tie on television, eating his tie. He was terrified, and so he had everybody else around him terrified and believing it too. It never made any sense to me that the Russian strategy would have been to take Tbilisi. That would have meant, that would have meant holding enemy territory.
Yeah.
It didn't make sense to me that they would do it. It was clear that they planned to take back South Ossetia, maybe a bit more territory, and teach everybody.
Well, as you said a while ago, earlier in the show, the Putin, and we're just using Putin as a synecdoche or metonymy for whoever is running Russia right now, it's a very patient group, and they've learned patience, and they've learned the value of not only of sticking by your allies, but settling for limited goals, not going all out. So I think everybody expected them, once they started winning, to do some onward until we've taken the whole of Georgia, and they weren't quite prepared for the sort of restraint that the Russian military has been showing lately.
Yeah, they weren't prepared for the restraint because, A, it's not something that we would do, certainly under W, and B, it didn't fit into the new image of Russia that everyone was selling to everybody this wildly imperialist, they want to take over all of Europe again and reconstitute their whole empire. It doesn't fit into that narrative if they're actually very disciplined about what their goals are and limited goals, especially when we were totally out of control at that time.
Yeah.
So I'll describe what happened when I went. Well, the next day, after the Georgians fled Gori, the Russian press pool, the Russian, brought us back in the APCs back to Vladikavkaz, and then the next day they brought us back into South Ossetia in the armored personnel carrier. We got to see some Georgian villages. And then that had been burned out, and then we went into Gori. And Gori is a nice Georgian city, small, medium-sized city. And it was totally empty when we were there, except for the Russian occupiers. And it has this really big, large square in the center where the administrative building is. And they told us journalists to go run around and look for what we want. Everyone was looking for a cluster bomb. That they could use to prove that Russians were committing war crimes. That's what I remember, is that the journalists were running around trying to find any evidence of cluster bombs so that they can accuse Russians of war crimes. And I spent a little time hanging out with the commander there. I'd have to go back to my notes to remember his name. And he started talking about the humiliation that Russia had been through from the late 80s through the 90s. And how everybody had badmouthed them. Everybody thought that Russia was gone for good. And everybody thought that they would never come back again. And now they know that, that was just a short period. Now they know that Russia is back. And that the Russian military is as good or better than any in the world. And as you can see here, we're restrained. We could go on to Tbilisi if we want to, but we don't want to. We could take Alaska if we want to, but we don't want to. This is how he's talking.
What, did he actually mention Alaska?
As I recall, and I'll have to go back, I distinctly remember that, though, yes.
Wow.
And I remember at that point, because initially I was kind of like, you know, I mean, having lived through the Vietnam era, I know that feeling of, I mean, as a civilian and as a fascist twerp, you know, kid, I know that feeling of humiliation, and I know that feeling of getting some pride again. But as he started going on, it started to anger me. I don't know, like I thought, you know, it didn't make me feel good that these guys had this amount of a sense of power back again. And you just, you know, I started to realize, like, watching that, and there was a proof of it, and the proof was the Americans were gone. These guys were passing around laughing, like, different American war booty, like compasses and all these different, you know, uniforms and food and all this different stuff that the Georgians left behind that had been given to them by the Americans. And it just struck me, like, my God, you know, I remember Russia. I remember when they would grovel to Americans in the 90s. And I remember when they, you know, they would say, we can't do anything right. You guys do everything right. And we're barbarians. We suck, you know. And I remember when they, just the utter powerlessness of that country throughout the 90s and even through the early 2000s. And how America, it seemed like, we could do whatever we wanted anywhere in the world. And just standing in that square, you just realize, well, that's over now, you know? And it wasn't just a blip. It was a...
over in what sounds like a complete bipolar switch.
Yeah. And, you know, and you have to blame, though. I mean, this is part of the consequence of policies. Policies have been the Clinton administration by doing everything to back Yeltsin, despite all the evidence about, you know, about how awful he was and disastrous he was. And people would remember that in Russia. And then the bombing of Kosovo, of course, was a big thing. And then Bush went in and, you know, genuinely did overextend and hugely weaken this country. I mean, if you're an American nationalist, what Bush did was he practically destroyed American global power. You know, I think it's probably a good thing, because maybe we won't do as many stupid things. But if you're a nationalist,
as we both tried to be until we wised up. Bush was a complete disaster militarily and in every other way I can think of for the United States. These guys weren't just cruel, they were stupid beyond belief, and they were always pushing it too hard in the wrong places, and Georgia just seems like a classic example of that.
Yeah, and that brings me to one of the most incredible episodes in this war that did not come out until I think a year or two later when... Okay, so a kind of a diplomat named Ronald Osmus came out with a book called A Little War That Shook the World. Now, this guy's a hardcore Saakashvili lover, Georgia lover, NATO lover. He was deeply involved in expanding NATO. So this is not from a lefty by any means, basically a neocon. But doesn't want to die. So I guess a realist neocon, you know.
Yeah.
And when he came out, he revealed that early on in the war, so first of all, I should also point out, also on the 10th, we flew out the brigades that we had trained up, specifically the best Georgian brigades that we trained up in Iraq. We transported them on American military transport straight to Georgia. I found that, you know, I guess we felt we had to do something. But that was, I mean, I would, if I were the Russians, I would have taken that as pretty hostile. Like, is you ferrying these people back to kill us, or what's going on?
Yeah.
But in any event...
Yeah, a truly aggressive Russian policy would have been to shoot those planes down.
Yeah. So what Asmus described was that at a National Security Council meeting without Bush, because Bush was in Beijing for the Olympics, that the staff of Hadley and the staff of Dick Cheney and Cheney himself were talking about military options. And Cheney was putting on the table the idea that, you know, these are the guys who are always like, we have to do something. know, doing something's better than doing nothing. It's always their mentality. It's a very boardroom corporate mentality that they took to the war room. We have to do something, and Cheney tabled the idea of bombing the Roki Tunnel because the Georgians didn't do that. And I think the Georgians were counting on us threatening to do that as part two of their plan. First, we take Tsimbali, then the Americans threaten to bomb the Roki Tunnel, and the Russians have to deal with a fait accompli. I think that was a stupid plan.
I have to say, though, there's still something stupid here because you don't need an F-15E strike fighter to bomb a tunnel. What you need is a truck full of dynamite and a timer. It's not that hard to bomb a tunnel. We're talking about Looney Tunes physics here, right? We're talking about Wile E. Coyote stuff. If you want to close a tunnel, it would not be that difficult, and it does not demand an advanced armed air force.
You know, the more I think about it, the more you have to say, I think it was his cowardice. I bet you there was a contingent plan to do it. And from what I can tell about Saakashvili, I think he just thought, if we do that, you know, I understand, coming from this region, that means I have directly attacked Russia.
Right.
And I'm afraid to do that for obvious reasons. I'll have the Americans do that part. I mean, really, because everyone said that he seemed to think in part of his plans that the Americans were going to stop the Russians. He was going to deal with the South Ossetians, and somehow the Americans would stop the Russians. That's sort of
I can imagine that. It's almost like a military damsel in distress strategy. Like, I'm going to squash this ethnic insurgent region that's giving me trouble. The Russians are going to come in belatedly to try to protect their friends. And then, oh, help, oh, save me. And if the people you're dealing with are Bush and Cheney, you might reasonably, if not very intelligently, expect that they would.
Yeah. So Cheney seems to be for it. Hadley, who is a...
There's a shock. There's a shocker.
Yeah. It's like, I've already had 5, you know, heart attacks and 10 bypasses. You know, what do I have to lose? Hadley, who's probably thinking about his, you know, his retirement to Cape Cod and some of these other people, I mean, they go white in the face. And, you know, you can't tell Cheney no. So what he did was President Bush, sir, you've got to come back. We have a very important meeting. You know, Vice President Cheney has something really interesting to tell you. So they made sure they convened another meeting as Bush came back. And Bush was also thinking, you know, Bush is just thinking, all I want to do is go to Crawford and paint dogs or something. You know? That's all he's thinking about. So they convened another meeting, and Hadley says, so, you know, Vice President Cheney, he has a very interesting... very good proposal. Why don't you tell him, Dick? You know, and so he talks about, well, we thought one of the things we can do is, you know, we're running a Roki Tunnel. This would mean World War III for sure. One thing you can say about the Russians, I mean, it would have meant it under Yeltsin for that matter, probably. But definitely under Putin. It's not even a question. It would have meant they would have gone nuclear, because this is the paranoia and fear of all Russian leaders going back to the beginning, because they've had such fluid borders throughout the entire history, is an assault on what their territory is. I mean, anyway, that's any country, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously any country. That would have meant they would have gone to nuclear quickly if they needed to. And Bush just looked at Cheney. I mean, I wish he could have got inside of his head, even as simple as it would have been. It would have just been, oh, dear God.
You know? Yeah, that, oh, dear God, I'm the sane one in the room. That must have been a weird feeling.
Exactly. So, obviously, you know, that's an interesting idea. Let me retire, you know. He must have been wondering if there was going to be a coup, if he was going to be killed at that point, you know.
Yeah.
It's so crazy. And obviously he nixed it. And made a lot of babble, and they did a lot of babble about how they're standing by Georgia and Georgia's territorial integrity, but didn't do anything, and let them know they weren't going to do anything. And it finally hit Saakashvili, too. The Americans aren't coming. And, you know, he was like the terrified bully at that moment. He was the proud, angry, you know, full of himself bully a couple days before, and he was eating his tie by that point. They were convinced the Russians were coming there. They didn't, but there was literally nothing. There was just 40 miles from Gori to, certainly where the Russians advanced to, it was like 30, 40 miles to Tbilisi, the capital. They right. owned it, and there was nothing between them. They could have walked there.
Yeah.
But they didn't. And
yeah, well, I mean, I have very little trouble understanding loony people for various reasons. If you are Saakashvili, the one thing you might have wanted is for them to do that, because then you can play the leader of the, you know, Georgia the raped once again. Georgia
absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, you would want them to do that. And there might have been different Russian leaders who would not have been able to resist the temptation, you know, to do that. But Putin has always been, I mean, whatever you say about Putin, the guy's, he's pretty clever. He's not yeah. a crazy idiot. He never yeah. has been, as far as I've seen.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be.
No, I think they just realized that they hadn't used a fraction of the power they had.
Mm-hmm.
They also realize that doesn't mean we have to take it to 11 immediately. Yeah. Let's experiment with using some of the power we have and see how that works.
Yeah, and, you know, quit while you're ahead. Know when to fold them. I mean, that's the difference between idiots and winners in war as well. So yeah, they didn't. And they agreed to a ceasefire, Georgians and the Russians. I think Sarkozy of France negotiated it, and that would be the 13th. So it was a 5-day war. It was a complete, total disaster for Saakashvili. After that, every one of his allies from the Rose Revolution, that was the last straw for them. They all blamed him. I mean, inside Georgia, whatever any Russophobe or neocon or liberal, whatever anyone says here about who was at fault, I can tell you everyone in Georgia blamed Saakashvili, except for Saakashvili's little crowd. Yeah. And, you know, he then lost the next parliamentary elections and then disastrously lost the presidential elections. And since he had to flee the country, he's wanted for his involvement in the murder of a businessman, of abuse of office, Interpol warrant out for him. He went to
this is a busy guy.
Yeah.
I mean, well, he's not whining and dining people and provoking this war with Russia. He also had time to have somebody bumped off. Wow.
A lot of people. Yeah. I mean, this is what some of the things that were the final straw. And he got creamed in the elections. But among the many grievances, videotapes were released of police abuse also. So you started having, because of the typical neoliberal policies, you did have wealth come in. Like when I visited in Tbilisi, I mean, in 2007 and compared it to 2003 at the Rose Revolution, you definitely saw a lot of wealth come in, but there was an enormous amount of wealth inequality that hadn't been there before. Enormous amount.
Right.
And a small amount of haves. It's the usual thing. And really nice cars all of a sudden. And then a huge amount of, you know, have-nots. And the only thing he could really do to rally people at that point is war, anti-Russian chauvinism, you know, and ethnic chauvinism, the old thing. But his policies were not popular anymore at all. He went to Williamsburg. He got his friends, you know, whatever the Interpol warrant out for him doesn't seem to be too active because he's got good friends. He moved to Williamsburg. There were stories I remember reading in the press around here. Williamsburg is, you know, hipster central. So he became a hipster, and he was, like, hanging out in the food market where all the hipsters hang out, you know. It was very bizarre. And then the revolution happened in Ukraine, as I said. And after the anti-Russian, pro-West people came to power, he went out there and he was appointed to head up the Odessa administration. A lot of Russian, it was very pro-Russian in Odessa, and a lot of bad things happened there, too.
That still surprises me. I guess it surprises me more than it does you. It just seems odd that Ukraine, which is going through a sort of nationalist fervor, elects this guy who's ethnically Georgian, doesn't, as far as I recall, have a lot of Ukrainian background at all, and Odessa.
He did go to university in Kyiv.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You
made friends there, but.
Okay.
I think it's this. Number one, he's a nationalist who is violently anti-Russian. So already you're okay with the nationalists on that point. They speak the same language on Russia. They have the same goals. So already you're okay. You know, the problem is, again, that his policies and this Poroshenko's administration policies taken off the old playbook from the IMF, causing enormous amounts of economic pain in a country that was already reeling from two decades of that. So, yeah, I think eventually they're going to turn on these guys. But there was also this attitude among both. And, you know, I saw this in Russia again. But it's weird with ultranationalists. They have this attitude that corruption is genetically ingrained to the point that you actually genetically need different genes in positions of power in order to reset and change the culture of corruption in the Russia. Like, they think that Russia created the endemic corruption in Ukraine, that ethnic Russian genes, and that the only way to get rid of it is to purge communists, anybody who ever says anything pro-communist or, you know, had some connection with them. You purge Russians and you purge Ukrainians and you put in people from other nationalities. So Poroshenko's first cabinet had an American as a finance minister, Lithuanians, Greeks, Georgians, I think half of them were foreigners. They changed the language.
And non-Slavs, it sounds like.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Non-Slavs, yes. That was very important.
Wow, that is a really interesting manifestation of the self-hatred that always goes with ultranationalism in some weird way.
Absolutely, I know. And that's why, I think it's going to come to an end because this current administration has been such a disaster. And I think ultimately just ultranationalist chauvinism is going to be the only thing left standing in Ukraine. I think, you know, it is a disaster there. So the only other thing I'm remembering some of the my experiences in South Ossetia and Georgia, and what it was like to be there. I just remember, for some reason, I just remember I had maybe it was an iPod or some MP3 player, whatever you had then. I just remember I was constantly replaying over and over and over the Butthole Surfers version of American Woman, and it somehow seemed to make so much sense. It was my soundtrack. You know, I never stopped playing it, especially when you're in that APC and it's a long, several-hour drive. Loud, rickety thing. It was just sort of like made sense. But the last time I went in, we were able to just go in a bus. It was cleaned out and safe enough that when we went back, I went in a bus. In a bus in, so it was more comfortable, and a bus back. And one thing I remember on that trip was Fred Hyatt, our wonderful friend from the Washington Post, who heads the Washington Post editorial page and who published 27 editorials pushing for the invasion of Iraq, before the invasion of Iraq. He published an editorial that day. So it would have been, maybe this would be, I don't know, August 12th, 13th, I can't remember. Alleging that the Russians and the Ossetians had lied about Sinvali being damaged. They had lied and exaggerated about the number of casualties. They definitely did exaggerate the number of casualties. I think the number of dead total was, I'm going to try and remember right, about, well, maybe it was close to 1,000, half of those being Georgian troops, and then some Russian troops, and then the other half, I think, being civilians, more Ossetians than anyone.
Right.
So they did exaggerate to some degree. But
well, another factor in that is that it seems very clear that the Georgian army simply fled, as you said, dissolved, melted away. That does tend to limit your casualties.
Yes, definitely. But he had published something saying that Skinvali had no, was completely undamaged. This is in the Washington Post. And that the whole thing's a lie, and that observers who have been there said that the whole thing's a lie, and like the Georgians did not rain any bombs on it, and this is all exaggerated by the Russians. You can't. And so I think it was Peter Baker, the Washington Post correspondent. Somebody had sent it to me, and I got it through my phone somehow. And I was reading this, and Peter Baker was like three seats behind me, and I just turned around, and he was the Washington Post correspondent. They finally went into the Russian side, and I said, Peter, your newspaper just said we were just in Sinvali. We've toured around. We've seen Now, every single building is damaged there. Some leveled, everyone damaged, definitely by tank or grad rocket or artillery fire. He said that it's not true. I'm asking you right now, is that accurate or not? I need to know. He said, no, it's not accurate. He like was really ashamed, put his head down, like, that's not accurate, no.
Did he publish anything to that effect?
He published, a story talking about, and it was an accurate story about all the damage there, yeah. And that didn't bother Hyatt. I mean, when would that ever bother Hyatt, you know?
No, it wouldn't bother Hyatt, but good for Baker at least.
Yeah, I agree. So the other thing is that I was telling you before the show that through Vlad, my Ossetian friend, I was able to meet some local Ossetians in Skinvali, including people who were with the Ossetian irregulars. On when we got into town, this was on the I think it was the first day we went in with the Russians. Those guys met me when we were allowed, like the Russians brought us in, then they allowed us to go in a certain several block perimeter that they had then, you know, kind of had guards posted around. And these guys came in there, friends of Vlad's family, and we introduced each other and they said, fine, so on. And they said, and then they brought me around away from the press pool and drove me to a couple other area parts of town, showed me some stuff, showed me where hospital was, where people were buried in courtyards. And then they introduced me to a couple of these Kadyrovtsi, these Ingush and Chechen irregulars. As I said, it's odd because they're Muslim, but they're just paid. These are guys who are let out of jail and told you can kill and loot as you like. That's your job, you know, so it's a no-brainer for them. Here's a certain amount of money, and go do this, and, you know, just make sure you don't kill the Ossetians. And I met one of these guys, and I'm telling you, the first thing he did, he's like, oh, you're American. And we spoke in Russian, and then he kind of, he reached into, I'm trying to remember now, maybe it was even down his leg or something, side, pulls out this huge knife, really sharp knife, and he kind of smiled. And I swear to God, this guy had the deadest eyes I've ever seen. I mean, this guy was a killer. Yeah. I can see why, you know, sometimes you read reports about, the terrorists had dead eyes or the person shooting had dead eyes. I don't think it's, and then sometimes they would say, well, that's because they must have been drugged up. I don't think so. I think it's kind of a natural drug.
Yeah, no. It's always blame it on the drug somehow rather than the fact that there are monsters.
Yeah. And after meeting him, then I remember the Russian commanders were calling for all the journalists to come back and they were going to take them to a different part or maybe take us all out. And the Ossetian guys were very friendly and armed and so on. They said, so if you want to stay, you can stay with us for the night and we'll find you a place, you know. And this is after I met the Kadyrovs.
You can bunk with our Chechen friend here.
Yeah, we can play spin the knife, you know. and I just thought, you know, it was one of those moments like where if I was younger and more stupid, hadn't already seen enough death, I might have just thought, well, not, you know, what could happen to me? But I just lost the exile and seen a lot of scary stuff and saw that guy. And I just thought, I felt like in the cartoons, like a giant steak. And, and like the Chechen guy was looking at me like a steak.
And this, ladies and gentlemen, is why we have Mark Ames to be on Radio War Nerd today. He would either be dead in some slow, horrible way, or he would be a slave because they still take slaves occasionally, and they might be paying you some pig scraps per day to work 14 hours or so.
I think hostage is the main thing, and the other thing that worried me is these guys might say good things about me, but a lot of people would start asking, and I've seen this in a lot of hostile plays. I've seen this like when I was with the Serb side of Kosovo. Everybody started assuming I'm CIA.
Yeah.
And if I stayed, you know, that might start proving definitely going to be people who think I'm CIA. And in, you know, one of two cases, that journalist or so-called journalist might be a CIA guy or defense guy. I mean, it does happen, or you know, one of three cases.
And if you're not CIA, you're instead of a stake, a big dollar sign.
Yes.
So either way, it's not a good risk.
No. And I just thought, well, is this going to help my story if I stay overnight and write about how fucking terrified I was and I survive it? Like, how much is it going to add to my story? Because almost no American journalists were writing about this story from the side that I was writing it on anyway. And I just thought, you don't want to be a coward, no matter what. You don't want to be a coward. But I just thought, fuck that, no way.
Yeah, I don't think cowardice is an issue here. I think you're already in a battle zone. And
thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
I mean, hanging around with Kadyrovsky, I mean, God in heaven, no. I mean, leave.
Yeah. So I did go back, and I did get some good stories out of it.
Those are amazing stories.
Yeah.
I mean, the number of people who've seen anything like that and are still alive to write about it is pretty small.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've also seen, you know, when you see on the ground, I mean, I think from far away, you see this with people who write about like the Russian military and how the Russian military operates. You have this image now of this Russian military that operates as this absolutely efficient, perfectly efficient machine carrying out its evil plans and orders. And, you know, but from up close, that's not how people there saw it. The people that they were rescuing saw it. They saw them as, okay, thank God they finally did come in and they did ultimately what they had to do. But they saw them as slow and inept. The people that they rescued and were angry, you know.
Yeah, like what took you so long?
Yeah.
So just to sum up then, so the South Ossetia today, are there still Russian troops in South Ossetia?
Yeah, so after that, what Russia did within, I think, a couple of weeks later, they encouraged and then recognized where South Ossetia declared independence. Russia, Putin had told Saakashvili always, if you try military, we're going to go the Kosovo precedent. And because earlier that year, it's why I brought it up, in February of 2008, Kosovo declared independence on U.S. advice, and then all the NATO countries immediately recognized it. But to this day, a lot of countries don't recognize Kosovo's independence. It's a piece of a country that was militarily taken away by force to protect a minority, but that was a majority there. And so the Russians said, we now recognize, which they never would before, we recognize South Ossetia's independence. We recognize Abkhazia's independence. They're independent countries. They haven't incorporated them in yet, as far as I know. And very few other countries have recognized it along with Russia. I think like Nicaragua, maybe Venezuela. I'm not sure if any, maybe Tajikistan or something. I'm not sure if the other countries recognized it. But the Russians had said also to us, if you actually carve out a piece of Serbia and then you recognize, you change the borders, that's a new precedent, and it's what we're going to do too. And again, Russians aren't angels, because under Yeltsin, they've helped first carve those territories out. But that's where we're at now. And I think the relevance also of this is to try to apply some of this, and some of it does apply, some doesn't, but a lot of this does apply when you try to understand what's going on in Ukraine, how the Russians have operated, how to take what it means that Saakashvili is there, and how to read the way that Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, talks when he blames every single problem on Russians. There's a precedent for that, and people will get sick of that after a while. And, you know, the people who've taken over Georgia since Saakashvili left as rivals, it's a different billionaire businessman. Early on, there was this big panic in the neocon community. He's a pro-Russian. He's Russian, linked to Russia. Well, it's not that simple at all. They actually still want to join under the new leadership. They're still talking about joining NATO. They still are very friendly with the West. What they were definitely is anti-Saakashvili, and it's definitely a different... Saakashvili is just extremely unpopular there.
Right, because as you said, its economic policies were also disastrous.
Yes.
So people have not only suffered a humiliating loss in a war that he started,
yeah,
but the country's not making any money.
And also, as people, especially older people, will tell you, like, look, it's our bad fate that we are located next to Russia. And we all know that. And, you know, at times it's been really good for us, especially in the Soviet days when we were, you know, lived high on the hog. But we can't pretend that we live somewhere else. We're stuck right here. This is where we live. And so what is the point of being militarily antagonistic? It's suicidal. We need to live with them. We need to accommodate them. We should not antagonize the Russians. We should find ways to work with them. It also can be economically beneficial. We can't pretend that we are located in the middle of Western Europe. And it's just
crazy. And again, when you look at the neighbors in every other direction, there aren't a lot of good choices.
No.
It's not like the Russians are the only scary people in your neighborhood.
No, exactly. And on top of it, as anybody, I mean, all these people were telling me, going back the first time I went to Georgia, people who used to be more in the elite in the Soviet days, who were very anti-Russian, but with a sense of humor about it, I think, and a sense of distance about it. And they all said, the Americans are not going to go to war for us, no matter what anybody says. And, I remember sort of like, yeah, of course. And kind of I didn't realize what they were trying to tell me is these guys actually believe America will go to war for us. And they're totally deluded. And I think that's right. I mean, Saakashvili was convinced. This is the only rational explanation that he was convinced. And this happened again, I think, with the Ukrainians to a certain degree. They're convinced that America, that you can parse the rhetoric. And find enough there that America will scare Russia. And the only way America can scare Russia into backing away is to put muscle behind it. And they'll go and escalate, and they'll be able to dominate Russia, you know, and even go to war with Russia if necessary. The Russians would lose. This is their thinking. And I think this is really, it's very prevalent still. And I think we don't discourage that nearly enough. And in fact, we encourage it a lot. You know, there's always somebody, even if you have a Condi Rice or somebody going in there and saying, we're not going to stand by, you'll have a Vicky Newland, you know, Kagan's wife, or McCaffrey, is it Barry McCaffrey, or was it Wesley Clark? Some of these other, the NATO commander, these guys running around saying, no, we're going to arm you, you know, go, we're going to back you up, first you, then us, you know.
Well, I remember doing an article on the three dumbest neocon articles that had come out since the Iraq War went bad. And one of them was by one of these idiots in the Beltway who said, what would be cool is if the Georgians reacted by starting a guerrilla war.
Yes.
And that here's some cool, you know, Tom Clancy weapons that they could use to destroy Russian armor. And it was one of the most obscene things I've ever read, because I don't know how these people think. I don't know whether he really doesn't understand what it means to have your family take part in an all-out guerrilla war. Maybe, you know, Rambo never has a family in the
true
Rambo movies. Rambo never has a sister. Rambo never has a mother. Rambo never has a little brother I don't even want to get into it. But when you commit to a guerrilla war, it's not Red Dawn. It's not clever ways that you can ambush tanks. It's what is going to happen to everyone you care about in your life, even if you win. What's going to happen to them is going to be unbearable. And I think these people who recommend that kind of insane scenario know perfectly well that they're very safe from the consequences of anything like that ever happening to them.
If anything, it helps them. You know, the more martyrs, the more victims, the more contracts they might get. I remember that really well. That was... I also read that at the time, that article about funding and training for a Georgian guerrilla war to kill Russians, as basically a loser's whine. I mean, it really was humiliating, and it was a shock. It was an absolute shock. There were a lot of contractors there, and a lot of contractors who probably made a lot of promises to the Georgians about how effective their training and their weapons and their drones and all this stuff was going to be, you know, to keep getting more contracts. And they were all, they were truly humiliated up and down and like really helpless to do anything about it because you're not going to go to war for them. So, yeah. Coming up with Plan B, the brilliant Plan B.
Yeah. And so let's give them all these Acme devices that Wile E. Coyote would come up with. But come to think of it, Wile E. Coyote doesn't have a family either.
Exactly. And on that note, and he keeps coming back to life, you know? Thank God. I love
that. And on that, I don't know about happy, but on that note, all right, those were amazing stories. Thanks, that was great.
All right, good. So that's the end of our show, and we'll talk next week. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
So who was to blame for the outbreak of war? In the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, they say they can prove it was the Russians.
And Huel. Names Sturdy and Huel.
Sturdy and Huel.
They're taking me to their top-secret monitoring center, where evidence collected by this operative is at the heart of the debate. It's the tape of a phone call between two Ossetian border guards, apparently confirming that Russia began the war. One guard reports that a Russian armoured column has passed through the tunnel from Russia onto Georgian sovereign territory. What's crucial is the timing. The Georgians say the call was made at 3:25 a.m., some 20 hours before their attack. In the Georgian Interior Ministry, a senior official played me the recording. But despite this apparent evidence, Georgia didn't mention any Russian invasion when it went to war at the end of that day, the 7th. It didn't mention any proof until weeks later, because it says now it mislaid the tape.
So even though this tape was so important as evidence of Russia's actions, you actually lost it for a month.
We never lost it, actually, because it was in the files, but we had about 6,000 intercepts of the same kind.
But this was crucial. So even one so important to your case, you didn't keep it separately?
No.